It's a long way from Brantford, Ontario, to the air chair on Coast to Coast AM, but here we are, 17 floors above the vibrant Dundas Square here in Toronto. If you've not been to Toronto, think of a slightly less grandiose Times Square. That's basically the best picture I can paint for you. That's where we are for the duration tonight. And my name is Richard Serrett. And outside Toronto, you've not likely heard this voice. And it's a real thrill. I told George Norrie last night it was like getting a call up from the Yankees after riding the buses in Columbus. And all of a sudden last night, there I was on the phone speaking with the Mick. And what would that make me? I don't know. They used to say I had good glove and no bat, so maybe I'm Tony Kubek. Welcome, and we've got a great show for you tonight. Of course, it is Friday night, and that means 3 hours of open lines, beginning in an hour. And before we get to that, you're going to hear probably the most amazing aviation mystery you've never heard. Possibly even more bizarre than the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Stranger than many of the disappearances over the Bermuda Triangle. And we're going to reach out to a suburb in Moscow tonight and speak with a gentleman there, an American now living in Moscow, who will tell us about the ongoing odyssey of King Bird 50. First, the headlines, quite frankly, are dire. Possible swine flu outbreak at New York School Prep School. Most fatal flu victims aged between 25 and 45. Swine flu could infect trade and travel. Schwarzenegger has rigorous plan. World Health Organization ready with antivirals. The CDC says it's too late to contain. 60 dead. Mexico City launches a huge vaccination campaign. Close to 1,000 suspected cases. Of course, we're talking about this mysterious flu outbreak. Yesterday, of course, news broke that the CDC was tracking several cases of swine flu in the U.S., with 5 cases in San Diego, 2 in San Antonio, Texas. It turns out the CDC was looking into these cases because of a serious outbreak of swine flu in Mexico that has killed over 60 people and infected over 1,000. The World Health Organization says the strain is of high concern. The influenza virus is infecting and killing primarily young, healthy people. Henry L. Nyman earned a PhD at the University of Southern California in 1978. His dissertation focused on feline retroviral expression in tumors in domestic cats. He is the founder and president of Recombinomics, and tonight he is our expert flu tracker. Henry, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's good to be here.
Is this possibly the pandemic we've been hearing about?
Well, there's a couple different pandemics that you've been hearing about, one of which is H5N1, and this is not H5N1, but the other would be a pandemic similar to the one in 1918, and this has a lot of similarities with that one. So, yes, it could very well be a major pandemic.
Similarities between this H1N1 and the Spanish flu of 1918. Explain what those similarities are, Henry.
Well, they're both H1N1, and they both involve swine. And the 1918 was commonly referred to as the big one. Between 20 and 50 million people died, and there were so many people that died that probably ended World War One because so many soldiers were dying. And that did affect primarily young adults, and that was partially due to the fact that the virus elicited a strong immune response, and the people with the strongest immune responses ended up dying because they ended up attacking their own tissues. And so that's been one of the concerns, is that type of pandemic could reoccur. There have been two other ones last century in 57 and 68. Those were much milder. And there's been a lot of attention focused on H5N1, and H5N1 is certainly still around. But this one is swine, and it's H1N1. And it really came to surface on Wednesday. The CDC issued a dispatch from their MMWR, it's a morbidity and mortality weekly report. And as his name sounds, it's normally done on Friday, and this came out on Wednesday. So dispatches don't come out, you know, that often. And that was with the first two cases that were in Southern California. And they were described as being swine flu victims. And that wasn't that unusual, because there's usually a few each year that are described. But the fact that there were two in the same report was unusual. But what made it more unusual was the fact that they weren't related to each other, and they weren't in contact with swine. Most of the people that get swine flu get it from swine. And that is one indication that it's human-to-human transmission, but then the other indication was that they had family members that had symptoms. They were mild and hadn't been tested, but each one had a family member that was sick before they were, and a family member after. So that all pointed to human-to-human with two cases that were 150 miles apart, and that set off the alarm bells. And then the CDC came out the next day. There were five more. And, again, they were all in little clusters, and so that indicated that it was transmitting human-to-human efficiently. And that sets it apart from most of the swine flu in the past. Usually when people get swine flu, they have a fairly mild disease, and it really doesn't go beyond that individual person. And in this case, it was clustering, and it was going human to human. And then there were the reports from Mexico. At that time, it really wasn't clear what was going on in Mexico. There were these reports of atypical pneumonias with previously healthy young adults between the ages of 25 and 44.
Hey, let me ask you, why does it strike the young and healthy? Normally, when we think of influenza taking a toll, it's usually in nursing homes on the elderly or those that are already compromised in some way. Why does this particular influenza attack and kill young, healthy adults?
Well, that's what happened in 1918. It was, as I call it, an inverted curve. So instead of, as you said, instead of the very young and very old, it was really the young adults that were dying. That's because they've got a healthy immune system, and the virus is able to spread, and then they mount an immune response. It's sometimes referred to as a cytokine storm, and they have all this immune cytokines that attack the virus. And the virus spreads so quickly that that attack really not only attacks the virus, but attacks the patient's healthy tissues. And the immune response really kills the patient rather than the virus.
Henry Nyman is with us, founder of Recombinomics, and we're linked up to his blog on the coasttocoastam.com website. Henry, we don't want anyone to panic, but when we read a headline that says that the CDC is saying it's too late to contain, what do you make of that?
Well, this has a lot of parallels with 1918. In 1918 was really two waves. The first wave was a mild wave, and the second wave was a much more severe wave. The mild wave really put the virus into the human population and spread it, and people were not that sick. And that's essentially what's happened here. There have been no deaths in the United States, and these cases really began almost a month ago. The first two cases really developed symptoms on March 28th and March 30th, and they weren't even the first one of their family. So it ends up spreading, and it's kind of a silent spread because, number one, it's influenza A, so people either aren't sick enough to go to the doctor, or they go to the doctor and they test. And they tested their influenza A, and they think they have just normal seasonal flu, and they treat it accordingly, and the symptoms are essentially the same. It's only if they subtype it further to see if it's an H1N1, then they find out that it doesn't type as H1N1 because the typing is done for human H1N1, and this is swine H1N1. There's enough differences that the test doesn't work, and then you have to do a more sophisticated test.
Henry, if the first wave is somewhat more mild, then I guess that would be somewhat desirous to if you're going to catch it early, and then you build up, I suppose, some sort of an antibody to the more serious second and third waves.
Right, and that's essentially what happens, except the problem. problem is that the virus basically changes enough to come around the second time. So the first time people don't get that sick, they develop some immunity. But then when the virus, which is a swine virus, is in the human population, it interacts with human viruses, flu viruses, and it exchanges genetic information. So it ends up becoming more human-like, and it's got enough differences that it can, again, attack a significant portion of the population, but it's more virulent the second time around. But you're right. You're probably better off having the mild version than having nothing. But the mild version, just like seasonal flu, it can help, but people get the flu year after year because the virus is very adaptable and essentially has to adapt to survive. If everybody had immunity, the flu virus would disappear because it wouldn't have any hosts.
Well, flu shots obviously are controversial in many quarters, but would a flu shot do any good for the second wave if it's going to mutate anyway?
Well, if you're talking about a seasonal flu shot, that probably isn't going to do much good either way. The swine flu H1N1 is different enough from the human H1N1 that the seasonal flu won't protect a whole lot. There is an effort to actually make a vaccine, and it's already started, against the swine flu. And so the hope is that even though it changes, it won't change enough to kill you, that essentially if you do get infected, you'll have a milder infection, or you'll have enough antibody, and they'll cross-react enough to prevent you from getting infected the second time.
Henry, very quickly, leave us with some precautions that we can take to prevent getting this.
Well, what they're doing in Mexico is they're basically shutting down the schools, and they're telling people not to go to large gatherings. And essentially, if it's in the area, that's one of the things you can do is to have some avoidance of crowds and large gatherings. Other than that, it is still sensitive to Tamiflu, so there is an antiviral that does work. Using it prophylactically is difficult because it only works while you're taking it, and a dose only works for 10 days, so timing that would be very difficult. Having Tamiflu to treat at the first signs would be one way to actually treat it, but it's mostly kind of avoiding crowds if it's in the area, and of course washing hands and good hygiene.
All right,
helps.
Henry, we appreciate your time tonight.
Okay, Richard, it was good being with you.
Henry Nyman is the founder and president of Recombinomics, and tonight tracking the H1N1 for us here on Coast to Coast. When we come back, on the night of 22nd December 2001, something very strange happened at Thule Air Force Base in Greenland, and we are about to find out what that was when we're joined live from Moscow, author-writer James Corin. You're listening to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Richard Serrett with you here on Coast to Coast AM, live from Toronto, high above Dundas Square. And imagine an aircraft departing the United States in 1948 and arriving to its destination on schedule, plus or minus, about 52 years. This incredible tale, the ongoing journey of Kingbird 50, first came to my attention a few years ago. And we're about to speak with a gentleman living in Moscow. He is a retired executive with the Eastman Kodak Company and now a journalist, writer, living in Mamontovka. And James Corin is also the author of Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Haunted Russia. James, welcome once again. Good to speak with you. Coast to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm just fine, Richard. It's good to speak to you.
Well,
I've been looking forward to this.
As have I. This is I get more emails about this story, I think, than any other I've ever heard or I've ever talked about, and that is because it is such a remarkable tale. And this, we should point out, comes to you from an unnamed colonel with a number of years under his belt. This is a veteran of the...
Who is still serving.
He is still serving. All right, Lo. So let's dial back to the 22nd of December, 2001, and we're at Thule Air Force Base in Greenland. What happened?
Okay, we need to go back a little farther than that. We need to go back about 22 hours farther than that. In 1947, the only aircraft in the United States arsenal that was capable of long-duration flights were the B-36, which was a huge aircraft. It was the six. It was the big six-engined one with four jet engines to assist. I think you know which one I'm talking about.
Right, right, like a super fortress.
And the B-50. The B-50 was a highly modified B-29. It was bigger than the B-29, but it was essentially the same configuration. They were all assigned to the 509th Air Group because they were the only aircraft capable of carrying nuclear weapons.
That would put them at Roswell, would it not?
That's right. The home base for this aircraft was Roswell, New Mexico. It was not stationed at Roswell, but that was their home base.
Right.
This particular aircraft was stationed with a squadron at McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey. On the night of December 21st, that aircraft left McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, bound for Germany. It was part of the Berlin airlift, which was going on at the time. Now, I'm saying this because there was some confusion in the initial story about the aircraft's designation. King Bird 50 indicates that it was a KB-50. A KB-50 was not online in 1947. It was a much later aircraft. King Bird is not the designation of a type of aircraft. It was a call sign for that particular aircraft.
All right, but it's essentially a B-50 bomber.
It's a B-50A. Okay.
The B-50A. Gotcha.
The first version of the B-50. Okay. It was escorting a group of B-29s, which they had a far more sophisticated aircraft escorting less sophisticated aircraft. You understand?
Gotcha.
So King Bird is their leader. That aircraft left McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, made a brief stop at Gander, which was normal flight plan. They would then proceed to Thule, which is the normal flight plan. Make a brief stop at Thule and then go on to Germany. The B-50 itself could have made the flight directly to Germany, but since it was escorting the other aircraft and they didn't have that much range, it had to be done in hops.
Right. And Thule at that time was not called Thule, but that's...
It was not called Thule. It was called Blue One.
And it was under U.S. Air Force control, was it?
It was under U.S. Air Force control.
All right.
But it was called Blue One or something like that. But the jargon for it was always Thule, okay? It was always identified between pilots as Thule.
Okay.
It later became Thule Air Force Base, but at that time it was Blue One located near Thule.
Okay, so King Bird 50 is headed towards Thule Air Force Base.
Headed toward Thule Air Force Base. Its cruising speed is about 300 miles an hour. It's not a very fast aircraft, and it cannot go very high compared to what a modern aircraft can do. Several hours out of Thule, they encountered a very severe storm. The B-29s apparently went down low, diverted, and got out of it. The B-50 could not do this because of its configuration. It couldn't drop down quite that low. But it also can't get high enough to get over the storm. So they're having to fight their way through it.
This is North Atlantic, December. I'm guessing it's just getting battered by some pretty fierce headwinds.
It was considered to be one of the worst Atlantic storms in history.
All right, stay put, James. We'll pick this up on the other side. The ongoing odyssey of King Bird 50. James Korn is in Russia. I'm Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie, and James Korn on the line from a suburb near Moscow. And James relating this amazing aviation mystery. So we should be clear, James, we are talking about essentially the flight plan here back in December of 1948. A crew of 11 aboard this B-50A bomber en route from McGuire Air Force Base to Germany, but first a stop off at Thule Air Force Base. But they encounter some pretty heavy headwinds and are lost over the North Atlantic.
Essentially what happened was about 3 hours out of Thule, the aircraft just went off the radar, with everyone assuming that it had gone down. And that's the way it was recorded. There was never anything found, never any trace of it. It just went off the radar like a downed aircraft. And it was immediately more or less forgotten. And it stayed that way until the night of the 22nd of December 2001.
Exactly 53 years later.
Exactly 53 years later. Thule picked up an incoming aircraft on their radar, flying at what they considered to be an extremely low altitude for a relatively large aircraft. It was also going very slow, much slower than an aircraft that size would be going in 2001.
Was there any radio contact?
There was no radio contact at first. They tried to make radio contact, but there was no response. The aircraft continued to come in. Finally, the radio operator somehow got onto a sideband of one of the very old and now unused frequencies that had been a standard frequency in 1947. When they got on that, they began to pick up a call signal and a positioning signal. Now, in the days before radar was extremely accurate, an aircraft, when they were approaching a base, at fixed intervals, they would send their identification and their position and speed. Just a very short transmission to let the field know that they were incoming.
Sure. Essentially, they thought they were scheduled to arrive on time.
To arrive on time, and they were on time. They were exactly on time. The aircraft appeared at exactly the same time, clockwise, that it disappeared, at exactly the same position. So the first report Thule got on this unused sideband was Kingbird 50. Thule, this is Kingbird 50. We are however many nautical miles out. Our airspeed is, I don't remember exactly what the airspeed was. We, you know, our ETA is, and then they stop transmitting, which is the procedure.
Now, James, let me just remind listeners, James Korn on the line from Moscow, recounting an incredible, mysterious flight of Kingbird 50. We should point out that Thule Air Force Base, because it's in Greenland, and this time of the year, I'm imagining that the tower crew there would be probably used to receiving unscheduled flights, planes in distress, etc.
Very rarely. There was no aircraft scheduled to come in.
No, but it wouldn't be unusual for an unscheduled flight.
It wouldn't be unusual for an unscheduled flight, but it was rare.
Right.
Anything that would come in like that would be a disabled aircraft. It would be someone trying to make an emergency landing.
Okay.
And that's what they assumed. They also assumed this from the altitude and speed, that the aircraft was disabled, since it was going so slowly and it was so low. So they prepare a crash crew on the runway. They also don't understand why this aircraft doesn't have a transponder.
And why it's using this harmonic of a long obsolete Air Force frequency.
But, once again, this could they're assuming a disabled aircraft.
And this is being related to you again, just to remind listeners, related to you by a U.S. Air Force colonel in the Thule Tower.
Who was in the Thule Tower at the time.
He called you hours after this all
Several
happened.
Hours after it happened, he got off base and called me.
Okay. So radio transmission ceases.
About 15 minutes later, they're a little bit closer. They transmit again. Same thing. Kingbird 50, Thule Tower. We are however many nautical miles out our airspeed is, our ETA is. Then they turn it off. This progresses at 15-minute intervals, just exactly by the book, the way it was supposed to be done in 1947. Exactly by protocol. The last transmission they got was just as the aircraft came over the lip of the glacier. At that point, they were about 15 minutes out from the airfield. At that point, the aircraft comes back on with its normal transmission, position, airspeed, etc. But at this point, they should have been able to see to the Air Force base. They couldn't see the base. So the command pilot of the aircraft, his exact words were, Thule, this is Kingbird. We should see you, but we can't see you. Light up the night.
Turn on the airstrip lights.
Turn on everything.
Yes.
And when Thule gets the words light up the night, they turn on everything. You can literally see Thule in a storm a couple of hundred miles out. They're capable of lighting things up.
Let me just stop you there, James, before we continue along with this amazing tale. The colonel that's relating to this to you over the phone, how did you come to know him?
I've known him all my life.
Okay.
And we went to school together.
And how did he sound as he's relating to this story? Was he frightened? Was he panicked? Was he confused?
He was confused, I think is the word you could use. He wasn't panicked. He didn't understand what was going on.
And we'll see as the story progresses exactly why he was so confused. But let's just to move things along a little bit, because time is always tight. So they lose radio transmission, and at that point, I'm guessing the Thule Tower dispatches a search party.
They lost radio contact right after that broadcast, and the plane went off the radar again. All right, now they're assuming that the aircraft is down. But since it's over the glacier, they know that it's down somewhere over the glacier. And they know the flight pattern is headed for the base. So as soon as they could get one mobilized, they sent out a search party. Now, remember, this is Greenland in December, and it is as dark as the inside of a bucket of coal. There is no sunlight in Greenland in December. It's perpetually dark. So it took them a little while to get out and find this aircraft. But they did find it. They had brought it in for a pretty good belly landing. They did a wheels-up belly landing on the glacier with a couple of meters of snow under it. There was very little damage. A couple of bent prop blades and some abrasion. And
the crew?
And the crew was dead.
All 11.
All 11. But now this is the other place where they start getting suspicious about this thing. The aircraft, no one had ever seen this aircraft before. You know, we're talking about people that hadn't even been born when this aircraft was built. for the most part. The B-50 went out of service completely in 1959. This is a first-run aircraft. It was built in 1946 and 47. Most of the personnel on Thule weren't even born then. So they're looking at an aircraft they've never seen before, but it's got U.S. Air Force markings on it. They're also looking at a very large propeller-driven airplane, and they know that there is no such thing in inventory now. Not with reciprocal engines.
Add that again to the obsolete Air Force frequency that were they were using, and my gosh, these poor Air Force personnel at Thule must have just been up a tree.
They're looking at something that absolutely shouldn't exist. It's an anachronism. When they got inside the aircraft, the aircraft was absolutely intact. Everything was in perfect order. The crew was still in their positions, and they were dead. But they were not frozen. They were still, obviously they had only been dead for a little while.
So because it was not a terribly violent landing, I'm guessing then that the cause of death was hypothermia.
Hypothermia. They knew that they were close to the airbase, apparently, but with the weather conditions that were prevalent at the time, they didn't have the cold weather gear to try and hike. So they figured, stay with the aircraft, and they'll eventually send somebody out to get us.
Were they wearing...
Because they assumed, of course, that they were expected.
Sure. Were they wearing vintage 1940s uniforms?
Everything was exactly the way it should have been for 1947.
What about a log? Was there a log on board?
There was a log on board. There was a navigator's log on board. Everything was completely up to date. And this is where it gets really strange.
Like it hasn't been up until now, James.
this documents the strangeness. The logs on board indicate a flight from McGuire to Gander to Thule. The log entries are exactly the way they should be at exactly the proper intervals, covering a 22-hour flight that began on the night of December 21st, 1947, and ended on the night of December 22nd, 1947. Listen carefully. December 22nd, 1947 is the last entry.
Huh.
At exactly the time the aircraft went down on the glacier at Thule.
In 2001.
In 2001.
Yes, I think we need to reinforce that point. They left McGuire in 19...
They left
McGuire in 47 and they arrived in 2001.
But according to their log, it was still 1947. And everything was exactly entered in order.
So what did they do with the bodies of the crewmen? Did they...
That's a good question. The aircraft, they set out a recovery of, you know, one of those split flatbed things and a hoist and brought the aircraft back to the base, at which time they took the bodies off the airplane. They were taken to the base hospital and then onward to the base morgue, and that's the last time anybody ever saw them.
Did your colonel friend see, was he part of the search party?
No.
Okay, did he see did he see the bodies in the morgue?
He did see the bodies.
These were young servicemen, I'm guessing,
young
then?
Young servicemen. The oldest one was in his 30s. The command pilot was in his mid-30s, apparently.
Did they have dog tags?
All of them.
Do we know who they are?
He did not see them, and it was not released. But, yes, they were wearing dog tags. Yes, they did have an identification on them. But that was never released.
At what point, then, does your colonel get on the phone and call you, and why you?
Okay, they've got a major scramble going on, naturally, with all this going on. They've got the base locked down. It was the next morning, very early in the morning, after they had everything secured, that he was able to get off base. Now, with a lockdown going on, he's not about to try and call anybody from the base. But this is unusual enough that he figured somebody needed to know. Well, I went to school with this guy. I've known him all my life. And he called me basically because he knew that I was a writer and that I was releasing to news services. And he was pretty sure that this was not going to be released.
Would he, do you suspect, been in some sort of danger had they known he was contacting you?
He'd still be in Leavenworth.
I can imagine, yeah.
That's why I'm not going to say anything further. He'd still be in Leavenworth.
And you know this gentleman well enough to say with 100% conviction that you believe his version of the story?
He doesn't have an imaginative bone in his body. There is.
What happened to the plane? What happened to the plane?
The aircraft was apparently gone over with a fine-tooth comb. They managed to get the thing put back together. There was very little damage. And here's where it gets a little bit stranger. Now, they can't keep this thing on Thule. There's interest in finding out what's going on, apparently, and, you know, how this happened. And it can't be done on Thule. They don't have the facilities. It has to be taken back to the States. Now, it would seem that the logical thing to do would be to take it apart, put it inside a C-141, which it would fit inside the C-41 easily, you know, once it was disassembled, and fly it back to the States. But they didn't do that. They got the thing back into flying condition, found an aircrew that could handle reciprocal engines, and they flew it back to the States.
Who flew it?
They found an aircrew that had flown C-97s, which is the transport version of this thing that stayed in service a lot longer than the bomber did.
So these would be older pilots, I'm guessing.
It's older pilots, but they found a couple of guys that could fly the thing.
Now, did these pilots know the circumstances behind why this plane ended up where it did?
No.
They were just flown to Greenland and said, here, fly this thing back.
They were flown to Greenland and told to fly this thing back.
And again, at this point, we've lost the trail on the 11 crewmen's bodies. We don't know what happened to them.
Absolutely no word on it, still.
And what about the log? The names would have been entered in the log, I'm guessing, of the crewmen. No?
No. Just flight data. Now, there are records of this aircraft, the one that went down over the ocean in 47. And I'm sure it's the same names. I've never looked.
But in other words, the original flight from 1947 that went down over the North Atlantic, yes, they had to be registered. Those names have to be registered somewhere. People have families. Those families perhaps are still alive.
Some of the families would have to be still alive. But anyway, they flew this thing back. And, of course, the only way they could fly it back is the same way they flew it to begin with. It can't refuel in midair. It's not capable of that.
So it has to land in Gander?
So you take it back to Gander, then you go from Gander down to McGuire, and then from McGuire to wherever they're going to do the testing. Well, when this guy called me, and I can't even use his first name, they had already started getting the thing ready to fly back. Well, I got... And like I said, his assumption was that since they're flying it, it's got to go the same way. Now, I have a fairly extensive mailing and contact list.
Somebody must have seen this thing flying over.
So I got on my mailing and contact list and got a hold of something like 2,000 people that live up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States. Calculated how many hours it was going to take this airplane to get from Thule to Gander. You know, if it's flying at its normal cruising speed in good weather.
Right.
I gave them a time bracket and said, look, if any of you hear or see a very large piston-powered four-engine airplane coming over or hear one, and it's in, of course, you and I are about the same age, we know what a propeller-driven airplane sounds like. They're different.
Pretty loud, pretty hard to miss. Listen,
you can't miss it.
James, can you hold on?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sit tight. We'll be back and continue along in this amazing voyage, the mysterious flight of Kingbird 50. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM. George taking some time off tonight to celebrate his daughter's birthday, so I guess I should also thank her for this wonderful opportunity. An aircraft, a B-50 bomber, leaves McGuire Air Force Base 1948, arrives 53 years later on time at Thule Air Force Base. What happened? I mean, there must be some explanation, and we'll find out what James Corn's explanation is, and perhaps yours, when we come back, Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. James Corn joins us live from a Moscow suburb. And James is the author of Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Haunted Russia. And he is a retired Eastman Kodak exec living in Moscow. And now, James, did this incredible tale, and I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, I'm guessing most people sitting at home just scratching their heads saying, wait a minute. 53 years later? Let me ask you.
For a long time.
Is this book in, or is this story in Footprints in the Snow?
No.
It's not?
Right now, I'm still working on this. We're still following this.
So the trail hasn't gone entirely cold?
Not completely. It's almost has several times, but not completely.
Well, maybe we'll hear from some people tonight, James, who, if they can remember back to 2001 or 2002, I'm guessing it was.
At the time this happened, what made me mad and what got me really going on this was that the air crew just disappeared.
The crew that flew it home.
That was in the aircraft when it went down, just disappeared.
Oh, right. But what about the crew that flew it home? Do we know anything about them?
Not a thing. Well, there's one or two small things, but I'll get to that in a minute. It's not enough to identify them.
If I could, James, let me grab a call here. Let's go east of the Rockies and say... No? All right. Let's continue along then and find out what was happening or what happened to that crew. You had some leads in that regard?
We don't know. And I'm a veteran, and it just kind of made me mad that 11 men that were found on this aircraft would just vanish. And I started following this a lot more, probably a lot more than I normally would have. But there were several of us working on it by this time. The word had gotten out, and we sent out photographs of typical B-50s so that people would have something to look at and identify this aircraft if they ever saw it. Now, remember, there is no flying B-50 anywhere in the world.
Except in a museum, perhaps.
There's not even a flying one in a museum. There are one or two on static display, but officially there are none flying.
Are they easily recognizable from the ground?
Extremely easily recognizable. It's a very unique airframe. There's only one aircraft that even vaguely looks like it that's still flying in the United States, and that's the Commemorative Air Force B-29.
Were you getting any reports then from people in the United States reporting this flying overhead?
We got several reports. Just about the time we calculated that it should be crossing into Canadian airspace, we got a couple of reports from just north of Gander that a large propeller-driven aircraft had crossed the coast. A few hours later, we got some reports down around McGuire in New Jersey that a large propeller-driven aircraft had come over. It went cold for several days. We kept looking because if the thing's in McGuire, it's not going to stay there. There's no facilities in McGuire to evaluate this aircraft, and apparently they're going to try to evaluate it. That's the only reason they'd bring it back.
Well, let me ask you, James, do you have an explanation for what happened? Was it the storm over the North Atlantic? Was it something on board the plane itself that caused this?
Now, I'm going to say why I think that, and this is going to sound out in left field, but it makes sense if you think about it. We're talking about a flight that originated in 1947. This is approximately 6 months after the Roswell incident.
Aha. Yes, we're starting to connect the dots.
And about a year and a half after what they call the Philadelphia experiment.
Right. So,
now, let's
what do you wait a minute, James, are you suggesting that they pulled something out of that UFO crash wreckage, back-engineered it, and put it on board this B-50 bomber?
I don't think they back-engineered it. I think they had a toy they didn't know how to play with. I think what they had, and I don't think the air crew even knew it was on board. I think what they did, and remember that there were some UFO downings before Roswell. There were several going back into the 30s. I think what they had was a toy they didn't know how to play with.
Apparently. Listen, let's go to the first-time caller line and welcome Stephen to Coast AM. Stephen, you're on the air.
Oh.
Welcome.
Yes, I got a question about the return flight. You said there were props bent on their crash landing. Where would they get the spare props, the mechanics to put them on and test the engines before they flew, and where'd they get the proper aviation gas for the return flight?
Okay, that's easy.
All excellent questions.
It puzzled us for a little while, and then we figured it out. It's pretty easy. The C-97 transport is the same airframe, and there were still some C-97s flying. So getting the props, it was no problem. The installation's fairly straight up. Anybody that can work on a C-130 can work on a B-50. And they had C-130 stationed at Thule. The aviation gas that's necessary is the same thing they use in the C-130.
All right, Stephen, thanks for the call. James, back to this particular piece of technology on board, perhaps, the Kingbird 50, that allowed for this, I don't know what we would call it, a suspension of the laws of physics and the space-time continuum, but I mean, something like that. I mean, why would they just stick it on board a plane and send it off hither and yon? Why would they not...
I think what happened was they had something similar to what they were using in Philadelphia. This predates Roswell. The one that they got in Roswell was probably smaller, since it was on a smaller vehicle, and not something that they had engineered, you know, just trying to build themselves. I don't think, how do I put this? I think what they thought they had was some kind of navigational device. That's what I think they thought it was.
Did your colonel friend make any mention of any particular or peculiar-looking equipment on board?
No, but he did make mention of the fact that they locked the hangar down when they started going over the aircraft. There was nobody allowed in there except the crew that was actually doing the evaluation.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. James, you're on Coast to Coast AM with James Korn. Welcome. Oh, he dropped off. All right. So, again, why wouldn't they just take off this piece of equipment if, in fact, there was some piece of alien technology aboard? Why wouldn't they just take that aboard some other aircraft? Why take the trouble of flying the B-50 all the way back over the Atlantic?
Honestly, I think they were afraid to.
They were afraid to take the equipment off?
I think they were afraid to tamper with it.
Who else is working on this case with you? Do you have any...
I don't really know now. It's been so long, I don't really know now. It's just been kind of a hobby for me for the past 2 or 3 years, since it started really going cold. I'm sure there are some other people trying. But we got reports of it leaving McGuire after about a week.
In 2002?
In 2002. There were only about 3 or 4 places in the country that actually had any dealings with B-50s. So once we figured out where they were, we got the word out to these places to start looking for an incoming aircraft. Now, the places involved would have been Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, Kelly Air Force Base in Texas, Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, and Edwards Air Force Base in California. So we notified everybody that we could possibly find in those areas, sent them a picture of the airplane, and without mentioning any real details, just said, if you see something like this coming in, let us know.
Somebody must have seen this thing land.
About a week later, we got some calls and emails from Luke Air Force Base in Arizona.
Wow.
And they had spotted the aircraft. It had been at Luke for about 2 or 3 days and then left again. And that's where the trail went cold. It was not seen again. We assumed they were headed for Edwards. But no one saw it arrive in Edwards, and it was not seen again after it left Luke.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies and welcome, is it Dot C?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, welcome.
I tuned in late, and this is unbelievable because my uncle disappeared in the middle of World War II under very similar circumstances. He and his crew volunteered to take a plane up that was going on an aircraft carrier. He was a Navy navigator on a B-52. They volunteered to take an Army plane up, and it disappeared off Eureka, California. Now, my father wouldn't talk about it till the day he died, and we were very close. He said, oh, long time ago, you know, do you have any suggestions on how I might be able to find, maybe under Freedom of Information? Because there was no debris. There was no oil slick. They claimed to have a witness. My father had a very high security clearance. And so he was able to make inquiry, and I have letters that say, Bill, you know I can't tell you anything, but let me just tell you, everything was on the up and up. But everybody felt that it wasn't.
That's a remarkable story. I'm guessing there are a lot of those stories.
There have been several cases like this. And I'll be honest with you, getting any information out of the government's not going to happen. It simply will not happen. The only hope you're going to have to find out anything is to find outside witnesses. If you have enough information about the aircraft, what it looked like, when it went down and where it went down, when it departed, you might be able to find people in the area that remember it.
Dot C, good luck with that. That's a remarkable story. Thanks for sharing that with us.
This kind of thing's happened several times.
I'm guessing there are a lot of these stories floating around out there. Let's go west of the Rockies and welcome Warren to Coast AM. Hello, Warren.
Yeah. What a show. It's terrific. It's filled me with nostalgia. I'm a veteran of the RCAF during World War II, and I served in Goose Towers and Gander Towers at the tail end of my career up there. The story is just marvelous, and my greetings to dear old Canada that I love very, very much.
Well, thank you, Warren. What do you make of this? I mean, do you have any explanation?
Yeah, there's a similar story in terms of the weirdness about an RAF pilot who, during World War One, flew over an old air base dating back to During World War II, flew over a World War One air base, looked down and saw all the old aircraft, SE-5s and maybe a SPAD or two and whatever they had. And when they went back, he thought it was lost. When he went back later to look for the base, it had disappeared. But the detail that he reported was absolutely accurate.
It just completely vanished.
Just completely vanished, and yet 1 minute he saw it, and a few minutes or a few hours later, it was not there.
Oh, my Lord.
So
I'd like to have some details on that story.
Strange things happen in the air.
Warren, thank you for that amazing story. Yes, James, it sounds like there could be another book here. Let me ask you, in the time that remains, about your passion, your hobby of the paranormal, and this book, Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Haunted Russia. Now, I understand that this a story of Kingbird 50 didn't make it into the book, but what sorts of ghost stories can you tell us about from Russia?
Well, the book is about Russian stories, so naturally I didn't put this one in it. This one, I hope once I get enough information one of these days to do this this story as a book, I'm still hoping to find out some more about it. But Footprints is a collection of Russian ghost stories. They're not the famous ones. They're stories that people just tell. People in your hometown, people that know the area, stories about things that have happened that only the people in that area know about.
So you've tapped into the folklore.
It's mostly folklore. It's things that are not widely known. But it's all of the stories in the book are completely documentable and documented. There is nothing in the book that cannot be proven.
I would imagine that Russia, given its painful history, the violence, the struggle, that would be a hot spot for hauntings, I'm guessing. Now, do you have a personal encounter with a ghost in Moscow?
Not with a ghost. I have a personal encounter with one of these stories.
All right.
And it's a special story to me because I do know the people. I have not seen the anomaly personally, but I do know the people, and I have seen the photographic evidence and was involved in doing the analysis.
I got about 2 minutes if you could share that with us.
Sure. The name of the story and the title I used in the book is called Our Little Hero, and it happened about 20 miles from where I live. Back in July of 1941, when the Germans launched their invasion, one of the places that they came into was this little town. There was a very shallow place in the Ucha River where it could be crossed without a bridge. And the little town is sort of insignificant. They didn't expect any resistance. So it was one of the places that were chosen to cross in trying to reach Moscow. Well, there was a factory there that built tractors before the war, and they were building tank parts, of course, during the war. They had an old siren mounted on a platform in the middle of town that was used to call the fire brigade if something caught fire. It's one of these big hand-cranked, you've seen the type they had back in the 40s and 50s, big old hand-cranked alarm siren. Well, the factory foreman's little girl, who was about 6 years old, I suppose, had gone out to pick berries. Of course, they weren't expecting anything to be going on around this little dump. And she saw...
Listen, James...
A column of German tanks.
Listen, you know what? We've whetted the appetite. People are going to have to pick up a copy of Footprints in the Snow to get the end of that story. Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Russia, Haunted Russia. The publisher?
Zumaya Press.
Again, please?
Zumaya Press.
Zumaya Press. All right. And, James, the website is hooked up to coasttocoast.com, am.com. Thank you for this. Open lines. When Coast to Coast AM continues, I'm Richard Serrett, filling in for George Norrie. All right, open lines now right on through till morning. And let me just take a quick moment to mention that I have a website. It's linked up to the coasttocoastam.com website. I hope you'll check it out. I have a CD that I've produced called Strange Planet. Contains 21 amazing, incredible stories, and I hope you'll take some time and listen to that. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. This is coming from a guy who doesn't own a cell phone. But the mighty Aphrodite, my lovely bride, insisted, you know, everyone's on Twitter, so I have to be on Twitter, and I am. And you can follow me or stalk me or whatever it is they say these days. All right, let's begin. Let's go east of the Rockies. Daryl is in Louisville, Kentucky. Hello, Daryl. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing today? I'm doing great.
Thanks. Appreciate you joining us.
I'm calling. I had several experiences. Like, I've had UFO sightings. I've had psychic experiences. And I've had out-of-body experiences, and I'd like to share some experiences. What would you like to hear about?
Well, why don't we start? You mentioned out of body experiences. I'm always interested in hearing about those. You must be a very sensitive, gifted individual to be attracting all these various phenomena.
Well, yeah, I would say so. It started as a young age. Like my first spontaneous out of body experience happened when I was like 4 or 5, and around the same time, like I used to see extraterrestrial craft and aliens in my dreams around the same time. But around
when you were
time,
4 or 5, that
yeah,
must have been
4 or 5 when I was a kid.
That must have been unbelievably frightening.
No, because I think I didn't have a frame of reference, so it was just like you know, like a little baby, for instance, to pick up anything and put it in his mouth. At the time, it was just okay. You go to sleep, you see, you know, these little sharp beans, and you see these things floating in the air. It was really not much to me. You know, and I was scared about a body experience because it was so strange. Like I was like in a living room, and I started feeling really heavy and groggy. So I told my mom, "Hey, I'm going to go lay down and go to sleep because I don't feel too well." And as I was walking to the bedroom, I started feeling heavy and heavier. Like my body started feeling like lead. I plopped on the bed. I didn't think I was even going to make it to the bed. And at some point, I started feeling real good. So I figured I'd get up and go tell my mom, hey, I'm feeling a whole lot better. So I got up and I went to the door and I went to open the door and my hand went straight through the doorknob. You know, and I tried to open the door again. Whoosh, my hand again went straight through the doorknob. So I looked back and I saw a lump on the bed under the sheets. It's my physical body. So I went ahead.
That's how it happens. Amazing.
That's how it happened.
And so that was obviously, that was spontaneous. You didn't plan on that happening.
No.
Was that the first and only time?
No. That wasn't the first and only time. Later, I started floating out of body spontaneously. Like the first time I became aware of that, I was sleeping. At least I thought I was, and I heard this whooshing sound, whoosh, 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 like that going through me. And I opened my eyes, and I'm still a child. Opened my eyes, and my nose is like a few inches from the ceiling. And I look back, and I see my body on the bed. And I just whoosh, and I fall back into it. And around the same time leading up to this, I would wake up in a startle in the middle of the night feeling like I fell. Like, you know, I might have a dream of jumping off a cliff or whatever or falling off or whatever. Right. And I would actually feel myself fall and just jump, you know. And that's the first time I realized, oh, that's why I'm feeling this falling. So I'm actually falling out of my body, falling into the bed. So,
Daryl, let me ask you, one of the common denominators that people talk about with out-of-body experiences is this silver tether that connects their soul or astral body to their physical body. Did you notice anything like that?
Only one time have I noticed anything like that. This is like years later. I guess I was around late teens, early 20s, and I used to practice it actively. By this time, I read on it and stuff like that, And one time I was laying, practicing, getting out of body, going into trance and so forth, and I disconnected from the physical. I kind of floated up like a few inches. I was still interpenetrating the physical body, and I felt this very strong thing. It was like an appendage in the back of my head, penetrating my non-physical skull. And I can't really say exactly what it was, but the only thing I could imagine was it was the, you know, the part of the core that went into the back of my head. But I've never seen it. You know, I've walked away from my physical body. I've, you know, looked down, like I said, from the ceiling. I even existed as like a point of consciousness or a focus of consciousness to the side, and I saw my non-physical body floating in the air, and I saw my physical body on the bed, and I still
Daryl,
had the core.
How have these experiences changed your life, your outlook?
Oh, man, it's greatly changed my outlook. You know, fear of death is gone, you know, and I can't say absolutely because perhaps there's things I want to do and I'm afraid of dying before I do it, but it's not like a fear of, oh, my God, am I going to just disappear or whatever. Like, that is gone. It gives you a greater outlook as far as perspective, you know, like, you know, a lot of without a greater perspective of the different dimensions, you're locked into this five-dimensional reality, and some things that are not really so important seem so important. And there's people who spend, you know, a whole lot of time and energy on things that don't really matter or in the end won't really fulfill you or make you happy or don't really mean anything at all. Kind of everything seems, I wouldn't say less important, is that you don't try to, you know, I still go to work and do my job and everything, but it gives you a bit more peace, a bit less of an anxiousness and anxiety to things, because you realize this is not the whole reality. Matter of fact, it's a very small part of reality, the physical reality.
I agree with you.
So it really expands you and gives you a better perspective. So I'm very thankful for the experiences.
Daryl, great call. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's go west of the Rockies. Jeff is in, is it Cleon, California?
Yes, Cleon, California, and it's in the county south of Eureka. That's Humboldt County, and I'm in Mendocino County. And tonight I'm listening on KKOH out of Reno, Nevada, 780 AM, the home of Ross Mitchell.
And
the great announcer you guys have. And speaking of great, you are doing a great job, Richard, and I hope you come back again. Could you spell your last name for us?
I'd be happy to. It's S as in Simon, Y R E, T as in Tom, T as in Tom. I told the mighty Aphrodite as I left the house, as long as I don't lose their license, it'll be a success. So,
well, right,
thank
on.
You for that.
What kind of thrill is it having Ross Mitchell announce your name on this?
Oh, I get those shivers up my spine every time I hear that. Can you? As I said, it's a long way from Brantford, Ontario, to the coast to coast chair. It's a remarkable honor and privilege.
Well, I tell you, you do fill this chair very well, and I hope you do return. The reason I called tonight is a caller a little earlier, a woman from Eureka, had mentioned that a plane went down and it was under mysterious circumstances.
Yes.
And did she give a year or a specific date?
She indicated it was during the war, the Second World War, I believe.
Well,
but I don't recall a specific date. I think she said it was late in the war.
This really ties in with what she called on, then. I was a fire spotter in 1992 on a peak in Northern California that I'll leave it vague because I want to protect the record. But the what happened was the state of California was broken. They asked for volunteers to be fire spotters. So I took some training and went up there and loved it. It was a God's eye view of the planet. See out over the water, and you could see in over the redwoods, and fantastic. Well, during my off times, I would go in and I would read the log books that were still stored in that fire tower. And they went back, God, early days, early in the century. And I opened up one day to, seems to me it was like August 17th, 1947, somewhere in that vicinity. Now, these are fire logs, mind you, so only
right.
Fire issues are supposed to go in there. But they're
okay.
Government, federal government log books, or in this case, state of California log books. In this log book, by a gentleman named Pinkerton, like the security company,
yes.
Before that was bought out, Pinkerton entered into this log book that he saw silver disks flying from northeast to southwest, which would be along the California coast, which would have gone over Eureka. This was in 1947, and I sure wish I had a way to contact that person because, you know, we've heard a lot of stories about time warps happening around the vicinity of UFOs. The battle for Los Angeles
yes.
was in that earlier part of the war, I think 1941, 1942, off the top
correct.
Of my head, where a UFO crashed I think off the coast, and then one in the San Bernardino Mountains. So there's a lot of things that could be related to what she's talking about, and I'm really fascinated by your topic tonight. Glad you had that gentleman on. Footprints in the Snow, is that the name of his book?
That's the name of his book, but the actual story he was telling is not in that book. It's not available in book form yet, but he's working on it. But that was the mysterious flight of King Bird 50. And I think you can find it online somewhere as well.
Well, I was in the Air Force, and I've heard a few stories.
I'll bet you have.
Norton Air Force Base, as a matter of fact, which was near where that UFO went down in the San Bernardino Mountains. And there were whispers and talks about UFOs having been at Norton Air Force Base also. So I'll leave you with that thought. But I really find the topic tonight fascinating, and I'm glad you're on board with Coast to Coast. I hope to hear from you again.
Jeff, thank you for that. This is why Coast listeners are great, because just the depth of experience and knowledge that you bring to the airwaves with these incredible stories, and to be able to tap into this is a real pleasure, believe me. All right, listen, it's Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. We'll come back with more open lines, more of your amazing tales here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, let's go straight to the wild card line and say hello to Thomas in Santa Barbara. Thomas, you're on Coast to Coast AM.
Well, Richard, what a treat. Good job.
Thank you.
Hey,
appreciate that.
I'd like to talk about extraterrestrials in 2012.
ET's in 2012. That's an interesting combination. So you're convinced that somehow aliens are going to play a part on the winter solstice in 2012?
Well, I don't mean ET's in 2012. I mean extraterrestrials and 2012.
All right.
Does the actual astronomy prove that extraterrestrials created the Maya calendar?
Wow, that's something to wrap our heads around.
Yes.
So this cosmic alignment that's going to happen on 2012, that is going to prove that aliens are responsible for the Mayan calendar.
The precision of the astronomical knowledge that the Mayan needed to create the calendar is so off the top that it couldn't have been done by naked eye astronomy. And I'll just give one example, although there are more. This long count calendar was put into place over 2,100 years ago. And in order to have that calendar end exactly on the day of the winter solstice, the Maya needed to know the length of the year. That's the length of time from one winter solstice to the next winter solstice. They needed to know that length of time to within 40 seconds. This is 99.99987% correct. This is just astounding.
It is. It is astounding. Is precisely the word. It reminds me of the Dogon tribe in Africa that had this incredible knowledge of the Sirius star system.
Exactly.
Things that we weren't able to verify, I believe, until the Hubble telescope.
I don't know when they verified that, but yes, indeed, that took modern science to figure out. It's not going to be you and me hanging out in the forest looking up, going, "Hey, Richard, what do you think of those stars?" You know, and that measurement of the length of the year is also the same degree of accuracy of measuring the width of the United States to within 20 feet or the distance from Los Angeles to Tokyo to within 40 feet. It's just absolutely amazing.
It is mind-boggling, yeah. You might be right. There may have been some sort of ET intervention to provide this kind of knowledge. Do you think that that's going to be revealed to us in 2012?
No, I don't see any indication in the Maya folklore about the ETs returning, although they did talk about, you know, how they had a highly advanced being who gave them their entire way of life. I think their calendar really points to this galactic alignment, and people can see some information on that. I have a 10-minute YouTube video. I won't give a URL out, but if people want to go to YouTube and put in these three terms, 2012, actual astronomy, and they'll come up with my 10-minute video, and I also have some 2012 essays, new essays up on my website.
Thomas in Santa Barbara, thank you for this.
Thank you very much, Richard. Keep up the good work.
All right, it is Richard Serrett sitting in tonight for George Norrie, live from Toronto, and we go next to Rick in New Mexico on the wild card line. Rick, you're driving through the wilds of New Mexico, are you?
Yes, sir, Richard. How are you doing this evening, sir?
Very well. I've always had an affinity. I've never been to Mexico. I've always wanted to go. There's certain places that just draw me, and I don't know whether it just has this mystical feeling or sensibility about New Mexico. Do you feel the same way?
Not at all. A bunch of dirt on the side of the road.
Okay. I guess if you live there, it's just another day, you know, in New Mexico. But anyway, go ahead.
I'm just passing through. I drive the 48 states there, so... The thing I want to bring up is with your guest you had on tonight, James. I'm a retired Air Force before I started driving trucks, and I was a 20-year jet mechanic. But the thing I was going to bring up, I spent 6 years at Tucson at Davis-Monthan, and they have a place over there called AMARC, which is basically a storage place for old aircraft. You probably heard of it as a boneyard or something like that.
Yes, yes.
Well, I just want to suggest that as a possible place to look for James, because when he said that they had found that jet, aircraft at Luke is skipping a jump from Tucson there, and I can't think of a reason why they had put it on a fighter base, unless it was just en route to Tucson to go into the boneyard. You know what I'm saying? And what they do, they prep aircraft there for storage so they could store them for long times, and so they're preserved basically for any length of time they want to store them for.
Right, right. Well, I'll pass that along to James. Maybe I could send him an email and suggest he get his self over here and start poking around in those boneyards. And that's as good a place as any, I'd say, Rick, to start looking for this thing.
Oh, yeah. But
thank you for this.
Bring it up.
Appreciate it. Rick in New Mexico. All right, again on the wild card line, and this time it's Craig in Kennebunkport, Maine. Craig, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Hey, you're doing a nice job as a moderator. I like your style. But I have to tell you, as a ex-military aviator and a present AVA pilot for a major airline here in the United States, your guest has no credibility when it comes to aviation knowledge whatsoever.
Well, he doesn't claim to be an aviation.
Well, he talks about, this is totally out of left field. He talks about things that this airplane, its configuration, it couldn't go underneath the storm. All airplanes are designed with a configuration so they can go lower. He talks about transferring props from a C-130 to this reciprocal engine and using the same fuel. It's not going to happen. They don't even burn the same kind of fuel at all. One's avgas. One's jet fuel. The props, having been on board a C-130, the reason why I feel this guy's story hasn't been published, because it lacks credibility. Nothing against your show. You're doing a great job. But your guests need to know that there are so many holes in his story as far as aviation abilities of these aircraft.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't get on earlier and
put
those questions to James. I can't obviously answer those questions in his absence.
Right, I understand that. But as a pilot, I just sit here and I shake my head.
Well, listen, so. I sit here in the chair here and I shake my head and say, my gosh, this is just too unbelievable. However, as the great Bart himself said, there is more to heaven and earth, Horatio. Thanks for the call, nonetheless, and appreciate it. Let's head on out to Reno, Nevada, and west of the Rockies. Rusty, welcome to Coast AM.
Oh, thanks, Richard. You're doing a super job. And I just wanted to let you know that several months ago, and I can't remember exactly when, but there was a special on the television about what ends up where, and I don't know if you saw it, but Wright Patterson down in the basement or even below the entire Air Force base, they claim that there's certain things that are there, whether it be pieces of aircraft that they found that they've never divulged or even pieces of extraterrestrials. But I just wondered if maybe this B-50 parts of it might have ended up there. Or, because especially since they were at Luke Air Force Base, if they could have been on up to Area 51 or something like that.
Who knows? It's a mystery wrapped in a riddle, dipped in a chocolatey coating. Rusty's in Reno, and we thank you for the call. Back with more here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. I've decided you're not officially a dad. I've got a twin boys, 2.5 years old, Zachary and North. Both sick at home with some sort of a virus. But I've decided you're not officially a dad until you have to remove a foreign object from a child's nose with a pair of tweezers. And the other day, officially a dad. We had to pin poor little North to the ground and get the tweezers up there. And he had shoved a wad of paper. It turned out to be a little sticker. He's potty training. And as a reward, he gets a sticker, a little fish or something, and he sticks it on his chart. Well, he decided to roll one up and stick it up his nose. 2.5, he was probably overdue. Richard Serrett filling in for George Norrie. We'll get back to open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. And it's open lines right through on until morning. And first-time caller, Connor is in Salem, Oregon. Hello, Connor.
Hello, Richard. I have written down what happened today on a piece of paper, so it'll seem like a story because it is.
All right. It's important to take notes.
My whole life I've lived with depression and sadness, and I've never really believed in angels before. That is, until today. I'd have to start my story when I was talking to my mom about the show. Yeah, I had some problems that day. So she was telling me about a podcast with Ann Abler in Angel. And so we experimented with that podcast and the idea of angels and such. And sooner or later, it became night. And before I fell asleep, I asked, the angel, please reveal yourself to me. And nothing happened. The next day, I was browsing my local convenience store when I dropped my 54-ounce soda, and it went everywhere. It soaked my pants, the counter, my scooter, coffee machine, and the sugar. By the time it spilled, I've already been talking to a beautiful woman. The woman had beautiful blonde hair, an attractive thin body, and the most beautiful sky blue eyes you have ever seen. I could not take my eyes off her face. She had a wonderful voice and said, thank you. You've put some fun in my day. My day was boring. She refilled my soda and walked over to the counter with her soda, my pastry, and my soda. She paid for her stuff and left. When I went to pay for the stuff, the clerk said, don't you realize you pay for your stuff? So when I had to catch her and thank her, she had vanished without a trace.
Wow. And this is a true story?
Yeah.
Now, Connor, you're not pulling my leg, are you?
No, I'm not pulling your leg. It's really happening.
Now, it says here you're 12 years old. You're a fine writer for a 12-year-old. I hope you're considering a career in writing.
Oh, I was thinking of it.
Good. Well, I hope you do. Now, 12 years old, I couldn't help notice how you began that fine passage by saying that at 12 years old, your life has been filled with sadness and depression, and you're too young to have a life filled with sadness and depression. So know, Connor, know in your heart that angels are out there and they're watching over you. And I'm convinced that you encountered one. And so I hope you'll take great comfort in that. I think you have.
I was able to actually talk to them sometimes.
You are?
Yeah.
So this wasn't the first angel you've encountered then?
Oh, no. I suppose I've talked to them and I've tried. In fact, the first time I even tried this, in fact, when I heard of it, I was at home, and I have a hamster, and his little water thing, his little ball is inside of it, so it moves around whenever he drinks. And so I asked, just in general, everywhere, if there are angels, can you make a sign? And I heard that little ball move. And every time I asked like three different times, and after that, always that little ball went.
They pick some very subtle means to tell us that they're around, don't they? Listen, you know what? By my calculation, it's about 12:15 out there in Salem, Oregon. You've got a whole weekend ahead of you. You got lots of playing and lots of fun ahead of you. So I want to thank you for the call, and I want you to get into bed, get a good night's rest, and go forth into the weekend and have fun. Can you promise me you'll do that, Connor?
Sure.
All right. Thank you for that. Matthew is in Farmington, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Hello, Matthew. Good morning.
Richard, greetings and salutations from southwestern Pennsylvania.
Beautiful state. I love driving through Pennsylvania.
It is beautiful. I've always loved it here.
What's going on, Matthew?
Well, I thought he had open lines tonight, so I figured I'd call up. I've been into paranormal research for about 7 years now. My inspiration was, of course, Art Bell. I started listening to the show back in 96, and well, I've been a fan ever since of Coast to Coast AM. Went out with my friends years ago, thought, well, you know, EVPs, that sounds interesting. And we tried it. My goodness, if it doesn't really work.
What did you try? What did you try?
You mean what technique, or where did we go, or...
No, were you looking for ghosts? Were you trying to capture an EVP or an orb on a photograph? What were you looking for?
Yeah, we were trying to capture an EVP, which was astounding. We went to a local paranormal hotspot, and we set up the recorders, and then we just started talking amongst ourselves and tried to address the spirits and talk amongst them. And right toward the end, right as we were about ready to shut everything down, I said, well, we've enjoyed the time we've spent here tonight. We're going to come back in the future to speak with you some more. And then while reviewing the audios later that night, there was a female voice that said, I'd probably be gone.
And were you able to, did you have to enhance the audio, or was it clear as day?
No, that's one of my high-grade EVPs.
That's what they call a grade A, right?
Yes, absolutely.
A grade A EVP. I'd love to hear that.
Grade A because of the audio, but grade A because it's an interactive. It's a direct answer to a direct question.
Okay. I'm always curious, and you're the researcher here in this field. Why is it that we only hear the electronic voice phenomenon when we play it back and review the tape? Why don't we hear it in real time when it's actually being said by the spirit? Do you have any theories on that?
Well, I have a lot of theories on that. Basically, a spirit is an electrical field. I mean, at the point of death, what's the only thing that changes about our body? Well, the electrical field, the electrical current that goes through our body, it leaves the body. That's my understanding. That's the spirit leaving the body. Now, as you know, and I'm sure as many AM listeners know, when you're listening to the radio and there's a thunderstorm going on outside, okay, and the lightning cracks, what's the effect? You get like a static pop on your radio, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's because that's the electricity interacting with a device with electromagnetic fields. Now, what if a lower level of electricity comes into contact with an electromagnetic device? Rather than an audio pop, it may come, if there's consciousness within it, it may come through in the form of language.
Interesting. Okay. Now, the second question is, I've been told that ghost hunters are looking for EVPs have more success with a digital recording device rather than analog. Is that true? And if so, why?
No, that's not true at all. That's actually opposite. I have found that I have a much higher success rate with analog recorders as compared to digital recorders.
Ah, okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, a digital recorder, basically because of the parameters that it uses, it has to round off sound values. And by doing this, it eliminates a lot of EVPs, whereas an analog recorder doesn't have that limitation.
Right. We love that warm analog, the old vinyl records, whereas the CDs, the first thing we noticed was it took a lot of the high and the low end. So that makes sense. That makes sense. So where are you going with this research? I mean, are you what are you hoping to accomplish with all this? Do you have a collection of EVPs?
I have 42 EVPs that I've recorded over 7 years. And, of course, many of the members of my group, they have EVPs of their own as well. And we've been at this for a long time. And we figured we'd like to do a first. We'd like to try something that no one else has ever tried before. And we're just sitting at our local coffee shop, we're sipping coffees, and I looked up at my friends and I said, let's go to Titanic. Let's charter a boat, and let's go right out there where she sank, and let's record for EVPs. To my knowledge, this has never been done.
That is, that's a brilliant idea. Well, you better act on that quickly because someone's going to jump all over that.
Well,
Matthew,
I believe some of them are.
good luck with it.
Thank you.
Now, are you anywhere near Gettysburg?
I'm very near Gettysburg. We were on a ghost hunt there a year and a half ago.
I'm guessing you grabbed a lot of EVPs there.
We got nothing there. Sometimes that just happens. You'll go on a research session. You'll do everything right, but sometimes just nothing happens.
All right, Matthew. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure speaking with you. All right, wild card again, and this time it's Kyle in Stephenville, Texas. Hello, Kyle. Welcome to Coast AM.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Now, were you a witness to those amazing Stephenville lights?
No, sir, but I saw some back in 98 that it changed my whole outlook. Hell, after seeing that, I decided possible hell the Tooth Fairy and Bigfoot and Santa Claus and Bin Laden could all be playing cars down in Palm Springs somewhere. it certainly got rid of the doubt and Thomas in me, but I was deer leaf, and it was a real familiar turf. And I noticed over on the right upper side of the other road, it's Farm to Market Road there. It was like a blue globe, and I thought, well, that's probably one of those they do game surveys down here occasionally on those little coppers, kind of like the ones from MASH. Little tiny ones. I thought his daughter didn't have any lights on. It just looked like the front globe of one. But it came over, and then it came down on my left side, and it appeared to have like a red sand, kind of, for lack of, I don't know, kind of a fire-ish thing, and it was very, it was closed up from the rest of the elements because it was just kind of spinning, and I thought, man, somebody's playing a joke. And I got out of the vehicle and I looked. I expected kids to come out of the bridge right there. They must have been flying something at first, and it appeared like a, you know, large beach ball there. But I knew where the trees were, and it was between me and these trees. And so I kind of knew what size I thought it was. Well, it at the bottom with such, I mean, the stops and starts were abrupt. It reminded me of a stage light, like whenever you cut one down to a smaller size and then you fire it back up to a bigger size. It was,
yes.
It moved away from me. I mean, complete, like, just like, it looked like it was sitting still at first, and it got smaller, but then I noticed it went down the river bottom. And, but when it sat down, it was so strange. It was about 7 yards from the road. When it sat down, it was as big as what the downtown, old three-story buildings are here downtown, but it was perfectly round. And it was huge at this point. I knew it had just been in front of me. It's kind of like Tinkerbell at the beginning of Wonderful World of Disney. You know, that little, it kind of did that and then shot off. But when it sat down in the little pasture there, it had a red and green equator. It just started, I thought, this is too much. Because it looked big as a hotel then. It was sitting pretty close. And I just cut off the truck and sat there and watched it do its thing. And I was really
as big as a hotel. You described it as big as a hotel.
But it had just been. I know where it had just been, and how small it had to have been where it was when it was closer between me and these trees right off the bridge. But I never took my eyes off of it. So it nearly like it wormed hold or into. I don't know. It defies explanation. But after it had the equator that was red and green in the center, then it continued to kind of pulse with that pinkish red, sandish looking fire that was kind of slowly churning in the center, and then it lit up on the top with baguettes of all various shapes and various colors, all the same shape, and then on the bottom it lit up with a variety of color of baguette shaped lights. And between all these baguette lights, it was still a pulsing pink with that red and green equator just strobing fast, and it shot off river bottom again, and I watched it. I never took my eyes off it. When it went out to a speck, came back down, flew across the sky just like it, and then right before it took a several thousand foot dive.
Only if you could get the FAA radar reports, like a couple of UFO researchers were able to do after that big Stephenville lights episode, and actual verification of what was seen on the ground by eyewitnesses, confirmed by the FAA radar reports. It's worth a shot, you know. Through the Freedom of Information Act, maybe you could get a hold of that and find out exactly what was in the sky that day. Man, something strange going on in Stephenville. It's a hotbed of UFO activity. Thanks for the call, Kyle. Appreciate it. All right, to the wild card line we go again. And David in Pasadena, California, you're on the air.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning.
I've enjoyed your show. You really have a nice, smooth style, and you're a very gracious guy. I bring up a totally different subject, if it's okay. I spent a lot of time looking at the federal government's statistics on this, that, and the other, and something that in our hurry to try to solve an awful lot of the problems that we're faced with that's being missed is that Medicare is collapsing and probably will be, in terms of the hospital capability, probably will be done in the next 5 years, according to the report that Medicare Trust Fund handed to Congress last year. There are 43 million people currently eligible for Medicare benefits. By 2017, there are supposed to be 72 million. And what I think is fascinating with people talking about 2012 is that if you take just say 1.5% of 70 million people, which is about our violent criminal element in the United States, you multiply that by 70 million. We have an awful lot of civil unrest. I think we're looking at a meltdown, and I don't think anybody's watching.
Well, you know, you look at these staggering deficits that the Barack Obama administration is facing, and they're not even including the unfunded liabilities, things like Social Security and Medicare and all of these things that are going to happen in the future. I did hear Gerald Celente speaking with George Norrie several weeks ago, talking about exactly that, the level of the potential for civil unrest, and really delivering some dire warnings. A lot of incredible problems in the United States right now, around the world. But
I actually have a solution that I've been working on, and I'm going to be publishing it in the next year. It's taken me about 20 years to put together from my time in practice, the relationship between the physician, the patient, the hospital, and the payer is what's driving something that extends throughout the government, and that is the promise by the government to protect, to do what we ask it to do, is fueled by the number of requests we make so that the patient pushes the physician. The physician works on a fee-for-service basis, which means that the more things he or she has to do because somebody's sick, the more money they make, which means they're at conflict of interest with every patient. The physician uses the hospital as a testing ground and a practice area for the manufacturer, who has time to invent things the physician doesn't have time to study. Everybody thinks that doctors go to medical school to learn to practice medicine. We don't. And the hospital then is, with 20% of the population drives 80% of the cost. That pushes the payers. The payers dictate to the government how much they think it's going to cost based on generalizations. The government doubles the generalizations and doubles and more than doubles the number of people that are supposed to react with this.
David, keep working on this because they're going to need some innovative thinkers like you to dig out from under this mess. Listen, we're grappling with healthcare issues up here, the one-payer, one-provider system. It's not exactly broken, but it's not working the way we'd like it to. So we certainly share that in common. West of the Rockies, Kevin in Fairbanks, Alaska. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Richard. Welcome to the Coast to Coast family.
I tell you, I've been on the job one day, and it feels like family.
It is. I don't know if they really understand how much of a support group that this show really is, and I just wanted to, send that appreciation out. So
what's
going on? Wanted to call and verify or kind of back up that guy. I just tuned in the middle of a story, so I didn't hear it all, but I just heard him talking about his OBE.
Oh, the gentleman from Louisville, Kentucky, the out-of-body experience.
Yeah. Well, you can pretty much tell when one of those is valid by the, forgive me, I'm a little bit nervous, but...
You're among friends.
The description that they give. And the ones he gave were absolutely spot on.
Which one in particular? He mentioned a whooshing sound. The whooshing sound. Does that sound familiar?
They can vary so much. It's a huge realm of different sensations. But the ones that start out is... You can notice when you're sleeping, you might feel like the bed is kind of vibrating.
Yeah, listen, I hate to cut you short, Kevin, but I've got to take a time out. Back with more Open Lines, Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. Broadcasting live from the Toronto studios of Coast Affiliate AM 640. Going through the garage the other day and some boxes. After you move from a radio station to another radio station, those boxes start to pile up because you tend to pack in a hurry. And I noticed this head sticking out of a box, and there was my old ventriloquist dummy, Tommy Talker. My parents bought it for me for Christmas from the Towers department store back in 1975 for about $18. I remember winning a talent show with Tommy Talker. Anyway, the mighty Aphrodite will not allow me to bring it into the house. This thing just creeps her out, and I don't know, she thinks it's haunted or something. And now I realize I never should have allowed her to watch that great Anthony Hopkins movie, Magic. Do you remember that, with the ventriloquist dummy? Anyway, will not allow me to bring it into the house. I'm wondering if you might have some object in your house, some possession, some artifact you suspect is haunted. Perhaps we can discuss as Open Lines continue. Here on Coast to Coast AM, I'm Richard Serrett. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie, who's off celebrating his daughter's birthday tonight. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to sit in the chair. And let's go to the wild card lines as we continue with Open Lines. Jim is in Syracuse, New York. Jim, welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, Richard. How are you this evening?
I'm well, thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the chronology protection conjecture put forth by Stephen Hawking.
Chronology protection conjecture.
Yes.
All right. Enlighten me, because I'm not familiar with with that.
Well, there was a show on PBS called Stephen Hawking's Universe, and he talked about it there briefly. Basically, he puts it forth as another idea to the grandfather's paradox. You know, if time travel was possible, to go into the past. I could theoretically go into the past and kill my grandfather. Not that I would want to, you know.
Accidentally, yes, and then you wouldn't be born. And therein lies the paradox, yeah.
Yeah, therein lies the paradox. So Stephen Hawking comes up and says, well, there's another thing that could also happen. If people went back into the past and changed the past all the time, then a historian's job would be a nightmare. So his chronology protection conjecture makes the past safe for historians. But there's a flip side to that. I came up with something called my grandfather's revenge theory, which says that time travel should be possible, so that way my grandfather can travel into the future and prevent me from going into the past to take him out.
That's an interesting that's an interesting theory, Jim. That here's one problem, and it's based on my discussions with Professor Mallett, who is supposedly developing a time machine, not to send a person backwards or forwards in time, because that would require energy that would only be available, I guess, what would Michio Kaku say, a level three civilization?
Yeah,
but he wants to send information backwards in time. So you could theoretically send something so small, it wouldn't require nearly as much energy, and you could use it as an early warning device. Imagine if tomorrow there's an earthquake, God forfend, in Los Angeles, but we could send that warning back in time the next day, and people would take protective measures. But here's the thing about the time machine, because Mallett's whole thing was going back and rescuing his father in a time machine. You can't go back further in time than the moment you turn the time machine on. So, for example, Professor Mallett can't go back. Let's say he invents the time machine tomorrow, and he switches it on. You can't travel back further in time than April 25th, 2009.
I see. You know, there was a movie called Prince of Darkness. Are you familiar with that?
No. Doesn't sound familiar.
It was made by John Carpenter about maybe 20, 25 years ago. And they had that same idea, using tachyons to send messages backwards in time in order to warn some people.
Yeah, this to me seems very probable. He says with the right, Professor Mallett, with the right funding, this could happen within the next 10, 20 years.
I also think it's possible because there's also something called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen theory, which is related to photon spin, and it's a little bit far-fetched, but something like that I believe can be done.
Jim, you were paying attention in high school. My gosh, you're an erudite gentleman. Thank you for calling. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for taking my call. Have a
good
night.
Over to the wild card line once again, and Pete is in Roanoke, Virginia. Hello, Pete. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you, Richard. Just in defense of your poor author that was on earlier, he's telling a great story, and I was really enjoying it.
If nothing else, it's a great tale. You're exactly right.
I loved it. One of my first real flying jobs was flying a C-97 out of Corrosion Corner down in Miami International Airport, and it indeed has interchangeable engines and props and fuel with the B-50 or the B-29.
Oh, interesting.
But he made a slip of the tongue. And he went in the same sentence from calling it a C-97 to a C-130, and you could hear every pilot listening in screaming at the radio. That's just, it was unfortunate, but it was a wonderful story, and when his book comes out, I'm going to go ahead and buy it and read it.
Excellent. Pete, thank you so much.
All right, great job.
Have a great morning. Mark is on the wild card line, calling in from Iowa City, Iowa. Hello, Mark. Good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, Richard. My father was a flight commander of a V-29 assigned to the 6th Bomber Group, part of the 20th Air Force Base, based on Tinian Island. He flew approximately 61 missions. It was after his 25th mission, which was a nighttime Pathfinder mission, that he received the Air Service Medal. He died several years ago. And since his death, I've turned around completely on my own time in the military. I am an old Army specialist, fourth class, from the Vietnam era. And I had walked away from, you know, having anything to do with that for a very long time. But since he died, I've turned around on it, and I now have my full current set of uniforms and all that. And this last Saturday, I was invited to attend a Freedom Salute being held to honor recently returned soldiers from their deployment overseas. being held by the Iowa National Guard, the 109th Medic Battalion here in Iowa City. I was invited by a major who's a friend of mine for 10 years. I spent several hours mingling with other soldiers and applauded wildly for all the awards. I know that when I came back from overseas, that there was nothing. There was absolutely
no. You didn't get the same kind of reception that you deserved.
I didn't get any reception. There was nothing. And so I'm very happy to see that soldiers now are getting some kind of honors for leaving their life behind and going overseas and facing, everything. And I just wanted to call you that. And, oh, by the way, Richard, my father's name was Richard.
Ah, you know what it means? A fair and just ruler. Was he?
Well, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, he was a good man.
I hope my kids...
He never talked about it his whole life. Wouldn't talk about it until just a year or so before he died. But he and I had a lot of talks. I was the only one of his sons to enlist in the military, so we had a lot of good talks.
Well, listen, Pete, it's 30 years too late, or whenever it was that you returned from Vietnam, but thank you for your service to the country. And I'm glad that you're going back and embracing your past and your heritage, and the best of luck to you. All right, to the wild card line once. No, I'm sorry. We're going to go east of the Rockies this time and pick it up with Justin in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Good morning, Justin. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
How's it going, Richard?
Very well, thank you.
Awesome. Well, I just got to send a little bit of a reply to that one guy who was driving through New Mexico. It is definitely an enchanting place to be, for sure. I'm new to the area, and it's very incredible. I've definitely experienced some out of this world stuff since I've been here.
In New Mexico, tell me what you've experienced, because I don't know what it is about the state of New Mexico. It just has an allure for me.
And I don't know what it is either. Actually, the first day I ever came to New Mexico, I was driving down through here, up near a little town called Chimayo, which is known for there's a little sanctuary there that's known for having this sacred dust with healing properties. And it was Easter Sunday when they have a massive pilgrimage. People from all over the world go to Chimayo to take this pilgrimage up to the little sanctuary to be healed from this dust. And anyways, we're down the road, probably about 2 miles from Chimayo, and I was turning around on the road. And I remember I looked out of the corner of my eye, and I caught a glimpse of these two people over in a yard. There was a man by a tree and a woman on a doorstep. They were both wearing attire from probably, I would say, about the 1920s, 1930s. The man had a top hat on. The woman had a long blue dress with long sleeves. It was a denim dress, and it was really hot outside, probably 90, 92 degrees. And, it shocked me to see the man wearing a suit, the woman wearing this full body dress. And the man walked over from the tree towards the porch where the woman was standing, and he had a letter in his hand. And he bent down very, in almost a British type, very proper way of presenting something to the woman, and handed her the letter. And she bent down to receive it. And she turned around and went inside. And the man stood there for a moment and sat down on the porch and just put his fist up to his chin like he was in deep concentration. And the whole time, I was absolutely captivated by what was going on. I didn't know if it was real. They were glowing, practically. And, the sun is very intense down here in New Mexico. But there was something about them.
And they were solid figures. They weren't diaphanous. They weren't, you couldn't see through them in any way. These were solid figures
Actually, you could see them from head to toe. If you want to classify an apparition as seeing only, the waist down or the waist up, they were actually full-body apparitions. The thing about it is, in retrospect, they were pretty translucent, although, like I said, they had this glow to them. So the glow seemed to almost make them appear translucent. You know what I mean?
Yes. Do you remember where the house was? Could you find it again if you wanted to?
I don't remember where it was. I remember specifically, I was driving on route, I think it was 530 or 503, the main one right from Santa Fe that goes all the way up to Chimayo. It's only about a 7 mile road. And we were just driving, and I turned around for whatever reason, and my conscience just shifted my attention over there, and I saw them both standing there. And, you know, like I said, the glow was so intense that I couldn't really tell if they were real or not.
Well, listen, if anyone, we can dip into this vast listenership, and if anyone knows that stretch of road between Santa Fe and, what's the town, Chimayo?
Yes,
New Mexico. Maybe they've seen something, too.
I'm actually from Portland, Oregon, 45 minutes north of Albany, where that boy just called from. And I actually called to tell a story about angels. I kind of got into that story, but...
I'll tell you what. Why don't you save that one for next Friday night? I know George would love to hear from you, and we'll hear your angel story. But that ghost story, I got to tell you, Justin, pretty hard to beat. That's quite a remarkable tale. All right, first call line, and it's Michael in Detroit. Welcome to Coast AM, Michael.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead, Michael.
I just want to say that you're doing a good job. And I wish I could talk to George, but I like the way you're doing things.
Well, I appreciate it, Michael. What's going on in the Motor City tonight?
Well, I just want to tell you, I wish I would have gotten on when the guy was talking about the plane disappearing.
Yes.
and coming 2001. Because there was another thing that happened, and this was whenever I was around about 14 or 15 years old, and they had it all over the news. There was this guy that came, and he came from another dimension.
Another dimension?
Yes.
All right.
Apparently he was gone for a long time, and it was 2000,
Sounds like, Michael, you're about to tell a story of a time traveler. I tell you what, let's make a date, and, you'll call back next Friday again on Open Lines, and just, sort of jot down some notes, get that story all together and ready to go. It sounds like a good one, and, we'll be delighted to hear it next time. Always love a great time-traveling story. And I know George does, too. All right, back to the wild card line, and Tim is in Dayton, Ohio. Hello, Tim. Welcome to Coast AM.
How are you doing?
I'm well. Good morning.
Good morning. before I forget, I honestly believe I have a free idea how we can communicate with afterlife people.
All right, and has nothing to do with, well, we have Frank's box, of course, which was created by someone, I believe, working off Thomas Edison's original plans, if I'm not mistaken. What's your idea?
I believe I could do a way where we can do it with the brain gate machine that Cybernetics has out of Boston, Massachusetts.
Did you call it a brain gate machine?
Yeah. In the year 2005, they came out with a machine for handicapped people that where they can use their thoughts. They had a show on CBS about it.
Okay.
And what I like to do is follow through that machine and see if we could try it with future brain gate patients after they pass away of hopefully natural causes at what time that might be. I've actually talked about it on the internet of offering the option to other people, just like for the physicist Stephen Hawking, that he might like to try to use it since he's the most intelligent person on Earth.
And, well, let me just stop you there, Tim, because I want to make sure I understand this. This brain gate machine is an apparatus that a disabled person would wear on his head?
What it is, they move this sensor next to your skull, and then handicapped people that can't use their body, then they bypass their nerve system in their back.
Right, you could send electrical impulses from your brain to, I understand.
So basically what it is they they can communicate with the computer with their thought.
So you're saying that after someone passes away, we leave the brain gate apparatus on that person and see if
No? What we would do is we would take, it's the sensor that goes into their, by their skull now. What we would do, we would put the sensor up by the ceiling, and we would, I'd like to spend some time with the brain gate patients. They would like to try this. It's up to them. Like, what I call it is a backup plan. Whatever you want to try after you die, please feel free to do that. But if that doesn't work, try my idea. It's free because we're already paying for the machine as taxpayers. The government's sponsoring it. So why not use it? It won't cost anything. It's just cross-training the brain gate patients to try it after they die. You put the sensor by the ceiling. Now, I had an out-of-body experience when I was about 25, and when I had it, I was in this mindset of analyzing. I analyzed the whole thing, and basically, if you think about it, they say that 10% of the population will have an out-of-body experience at some time in their life. Now, if you take 10% of 6.5 billion, that's 650 million people at some point in their life going to have an out-of-body experience.
That's remarkable.
Now, if you take that and think about it, well, they happen every day. Now, they're unexpected. They don't expect them. Now, if your internal thoughts that normally take you out of pain and into pleasure thinks this is the best option, you should do after you die. Well, then why don't we follow through and give it a try? What would it be?
Absolutely. It's a great idea, and I hope you pursue it. Thank you for that. Tim in Dayton, Ohio. All right, back with more Open Lines. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. Broadcasting live from Coast to Coast affiliate AM 640 here in Toronto. And during the week, incidentally, you can hear me online at Glastonbury Radio International. Glastonbury Radio International, they're out of the UK. Of course, you're probably familiar with the Glastonbury Festival. I don't know if you, too, has played Glastonbury. We just heard them coming out of the break there. I was thinking about U2. You know, they keep going and going and going. They've been around, what, 33, 34 years. I'm trying to imagine Edge and Bono when they finally hang it up and retire. And I just, with a name like The Edge or Bono, can you? I just can't imagine them being 80 years old and shuffling around in a senior's home. The name just doesn't suit the age, you know. Edge, are you up for a little canasta? It just doesn't work somehow. Listen, we'll go back to open lines here on Coast to Coast AM in just a moment. I'm Richard Serrett. Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. Serrett, S-Y-R-E-T-T, rhymes with carrot, or parrot. That's the best way to remember it, I suppose. To the wild card line once again, and it's Peter in Forest Lake, Minnesota. Good morning, Peter. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, Richard, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Mainly, I just wanted your opinion more than anything. You know, I've been had a lot of paranormal experiences growing up as a kid, and just about a year ago, I had a pretty crazy experience. I don't know if it was a UFO or what it was. I was driving back. It was getting late. I was up on Lake Mille Lacs. I have a cabin. And I was driving back, and there's a side road that goes around the lake, and it was getting dark. I was about 30 miles from the cabin. And I'm driving, the road is totally, no one's on the road. All of a sudden, everything gets bright white, and I couldn't see anything at all. I remember slamming on my brakes, and because it was so bright, I couldn't see right in front of me. I couldn't even see the dashboard. I specifically remember I was scared as hell, and I slammed my brakes. Next morning, I woke up. I was in my bed. I don't remember anything from the night before. For the next couple of weeks, I was just totally scared out of my mind. I wouldn't drive. I wouldn't go outside at night. I know something happened. I don't know what it was. I've been wanting to get hypnotized or something, you know, see if I can recall some stuff. I vaguely remember, you know, small things like lights and stuff like that, but.
You suspect that you were abducted?
I don't know. You know, I tell my friends, you know, I've tried to tell a couple of my friends, and, you know, actually a couple of them are listening right now and, you know, don't believe me. And
That's all right. Never mind them. You know the experience happened to you. It was real, whatever it was. Listen, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and I would hesitate to offer any advice. My only thing would be this. Do you really want to know? Do you really want to go under hypnosis and find out? Because you may not like what you find, Peter. Just think about that before you, just think long and hard, is all I'm saying, before you decide to go under hypnosis, because those recovered memories may just pull the rug out from under your reality, and quite frankly, you may never be the same. If you're prepared for that, then I would say go for it. If you're not sure, I would seriously take some time, talk to some people. There are UFO alien abduction communities online and elsewhere, and then make a decision.
All right, can I ask you one more thing?
Yes.
I don't get spooked too easily. Me and my buddy were thinking about starting a paranormal research group here in the Twin Cities. I was wanting to know your advice on that. I've heard a lot of things, like if you don't know what you're doing, a lot of people can get open up into some bad things, exploring the unknown, messing with stuff you don't know about.
Well, it depends on where you're going. If you're thinking about dabbling in a Ouija board, I'm not a fan. I think you're potentially playing with fire there. If you're simply looking to go out in a cemetery or, let's say, an abandoned house and take some pictures hoping to capture an orb or an EVP with some sort of a recording device, I don't think you're going to come into any harm.
It'd be more about documenting. Yeah, you ever seen Ghost Hunters or anything like that? It'd be pretty much the same thing as that.
Well, look up online. You may, in fact, have a ghost hunting society already in the Twin Cities, and then you could join them. And
there are
it's an interesting hobby. Good luck with that, Peter. Thank you. Back to the wild card lines, and Mike is in Los Angeles, California. Mike, welcome to Coast AM. Good morning.
Hello, Mr. Sarrett. I just like to make a comment, and it's not to denigrate anybody, but I'm in my 50s, and I've seen this happen repeatedly. And, of course, I'm speaking about the United States, but it also affects your nation of Canada. Any time that we seem to have definite internal problems here in the United States, it's going to cause a reduction of our civil rights. There seems to be a lot of impetus towards putting UFOs in the media. And it seems to me that this is purposeful. I'm not saying I disbelieve in UFOs, but it seems to be purposeful because the same people that are interested in these things are also interested in things like the Federal Reserve and the forces outside our government that influence our economy and our government. And it seems to me that whatever our government knows about UFOs, they've been lying about it and hiding it so long that the likelihood of them ever releasing any information is slim to none because it's not in their interest to do so. Why would they want to release any back-engineered information about energy sources that don't require oil or some other thing because they control us with oil? So if they did that, if we have little power plants we could put on our block or house that we wouldn't require the power company, why they couldn't control us anymore?
Well, Mike, I agree with you, and that's exactly, I think, the reason behind this 60-year-plus embargo on disclosure, for exactly that reason,
well,
the owners of the system.
They never will disclose. They never.
Well,
it's not in their best interest to do so.
You may be right, Mike. There are those people like Stephen Bassett, who is probably one of the world's foremost UFO disclosure advocates, who is very enthusiastic about the possibility of UFO disclosure in some form coming under the present administration because of certain indicators, number one being the appointment of John Podesta, originally to the transition team. John Podesta is said to be a strong advocate for UFO disclosure, not necessarily because he's running around seeing little green men, but because he feels strongly that it is the law. The law requires this sort of disclosure. So we'll see. On the first point you made, I thought it was a good one, too, and that is that perhaps this UFO discussion is being used as a distraction when there are other issues, the infringement on civil liberties, etc., that aren't being discussed as much.
Some internal strife in this country that you can see is forecasting a reduction in our civil liberties. I'm in my mid-50s, and I've seen this happen at least six or seven times.
Well,
and each time our civil liberties have been encroached upon, and you're going to see it again. You're going to see it again in this country, particularly with, of course, you don't have Second Amendment rights up there, but this thing going on with Mexico, you're going to see it again. And that was put in this country's constitution for a reason, because the people that had fought the Revolutionary War against their lawful government, the English government, were deathly afraid of having been, you know, the people in England have never had firearms rights.
That's not true. That's not true. Under common law, actually, and one of the most important jurists ever quoted, and he's constantly quoted by the Supreme Court in your country and elsewhere, William Blackstone talked about his fundamental rights, and he talked about firearms.
I understand, but you go back. That's all well and good, but you go back and look at the laws that are made.
Oh, I agree. They've been totally
each one of the counties in England and the overall laws going back. You could not, a common person, we're not talking about somebody who is higher up, even a merchant was higher up than a common person, but a common person had to get permission from somebody higher up, usually the local law enforcement officer, and if they didn't give it to them, they couldn't have a, in fact, a lot of the colonists that came over here under some type of an economic agreement to work for some company, they kept the arms locked up from them when they first came over here in the 1600s.
Well, we had those rights, and they've gotten away from us, regrettably. I'm a strong advocate for conceal and carry laws, Mike. It's very difficult to do that. Next to impossible up here.
It's already gone. It's just going to go more. But there's other things as well. I mean,
well, carry and conceal laws are spreading across the United States. I mean, there is some concern that there may be some backpedaling on that. But listen, let me just end with this. You began your conversation about UFOs. I think that we can talk about both. I think both are important.
I think discussion of
UFO disclosure.
Thing. I'll say this in closing. I saw what, for all intents and purposes, was a UFO. It was a long cinder. Slender triangular shape, although it was a United States UFO, okay, because it was clearly marked as such. It was only 90 feet up in the air, and I saw it with five other people off of Highway 40 in New Mexico. But it obviously had some other propulsion system that they don't want us to know about, that it was having difficulty with, because it made all our hair stand up like there was an electrostatic field being generated, and there was no exhaust or no normal type of jet or rocket engine on it.
No, so let's have a discussion about UFOs and sort of arrive at the truth. Are they made in the good old USA? Are they extraterrestrial? Listen, if reports are to be believed, trillions of dollars have been funneled into a secret space program. And if they have this sort of anti-gravitic technology, that would make NASA, for example, mere window dressing. They're sending up rockets, astronauts with rocket fuel. Astronauts are dying for no reason. That's an important issue to discuss. That's a civil liberty. That's one of the most important civil liberties, obviously, the right to life. So I think we need to discuss both, Mike, but I appreciate your call. Thank you for that. Over to the wild card line again, and Victor in Toronto. Hello, Victor. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good evening, Richard. How are you?
That's a familiar voice. Is this Victor Vigiani from Exopolitics Toronto?
This is Victor Vigiani from Exopolitics Toronto. Yes, it is. And congratulations,
right.
Richard. You're doing a fine job.
Thank you, my friend.
Yes. So I just wanted to congratulate you and let you know that we're all listening eagerly to you this evening, and let you know that Mike Bird and I just got back from the X conference. And we had a great time there, and Stephen Bassett put on an absolutely wonderful show. And actually, George Norrie was at the X conference, so
yes,
we had a full evening of George and just a
Edgar
wonderful
Mitchell
thing.
and others.
Correct. That's correct. Yep. Edgar Mitchell came forward, and Paula Harris released her new book, and just a great time. So we just wanted to mention that and your previous caller raised some very good points about why the disclosure movement just might get stuck. However, I disagree with him fundamentally in some of his arguments. However, I think that that kind of discussion about the way disclosure will play out, I think it's important for us to understand that this is not just the law, but it is a planetary issue, and it doesn't really stem just from the United States of America. The entire planet is involved in this, and I think the perspective of an international overview of how disclosure will come forward, either from France or from the UK or from Canada, this is going to burst onto the scenes within the next little while, and the United States governments will have very little control as to how they react to it if a foreign country comes forward in the way the French or the British or the Canadians just might do it. So I think it's important for people to understand that this thing is going to come forward one way or another eventually, Richard.
Well put, Victor. And as I said to Mike, I think we need to discuss both. There are some important serious issues going on in terms of the erosion of civil liberties around the world and the erosion of democracy. But I think central to that is this whole UFO disclosure issue. I don't think you can separate the two.
No, I agree with you. It's a fundamental right to know what our governments are hiding from us. That we have to understand that, as Jeff Peckman said at the X conference, we are the government. The people elect these individuals to go forward. That may sound like a very naive idea in this date, this time and day in history. We have a lot of spin-off intelligence agencies, the alphabet soup agencies that I call, that we just don't know the acronyms to. However, the fact of the matter is we are the government, and we have a right to know, first of all, how our tax dollars are being spent, and second of all, how our rights are being infringed upon in many different ways. And I think one of the things that in a democracy that we should not ever allow is the denial of truth. The truth shall prevail. And we are entitled to know what our government is doing, first of all, with our money, and also, too, in an ethical sense, what they're doing with the intellectual property that they have at their disposal that they've been hiding for the last 60 years. Absolutely essential that the American administration come forward as a leader in this, because they do have a lot of information. But if they won't come forward, there are other countries who are willing to. And this whole idea of human rights and the way people react to the truth is essential to this stuff coming forward. And as I said at the X conference, I spoke on Sunday afternoon at the X conference, and my reason for doing all of this is to keep focused on children in Africa. And I use it's not a metaphor, it's a fact that there are over 2 to 3 million children in Africa who will never, ever, Richard, taste a glass of clean water. And we do that. We take it for granted. We turn the tap on and it comes out. We have a responsibility to these children in a global sense to provide them with the energy sources that will allow them to, first of all, have a good education and food and a sense of freedom and to explore and to do the things and to also have a clean glass of water.
Well put, Victor. As the ex-conference banner, I believe last year, stated, it's not about the lights in the sky, it's about the lights on the ground. And more importantly, it isn't even necessarily about little green men flying around in saucers. It's about the technology that's being denied to us. Thanks for the call. Let's go to, the international line, and it's Elizabeth in North Vancouver, another Canuck. Elizabeth, welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you so very much. I've been waiting for a good hour, but it's worth it.
I appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Richard, you have my favorite uncle's name. And I think...
What is Uncle... Your Uncle Richard?
Yeah.
You have an Uncle Richard. Okay. Yeah. Good, good.
I think you fit right in.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Anyways, at first, what I wanted to talk to you about was things that have happened to me my whole life, like hauntings and stuff. But when I heard Connor on the radio...
Yes, the 12-year-old from Salem, Oregon with the Angels, yes.
Yes. I'm really hoping she's still listening to the radio. I want her to know she's not alone. And she does have angels around her, looking after her.
Have you encountered angels?
Yes, I have.
In what form?
Kind of like smoky, see-through.
Do they have wings?
I mean?
Diaphanous, yes. Do they have wings?
No.
No? Male or female?
Female.
Female.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question that's always intrigued me, and that is, how do you know that you're actually speaking to an angel and not being deceived
by the devil
and talking to a demon?
That's a very good question, actually. That's a really good one. I don't know what to say to that.
Maybe next time you encounter one, ask who sent you. Just a shot in the dark. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
All right, listen. A great call, Elizabeth, from North Vancouver. Have a good morning and a great weekend. More open lines right through until dawn. Live from the Coast to Coast studios at the affiliate AM 640 in Toronto, I'm Richard Serrett, filling in for George Norrie, and you're listening to Coast AM. Residents of La Junta Guerrero, that's in the state of Chihuahua in Mexico, reporting the appearance of a man-bat. You heard me correctly, a man-bat. They describe it as very tall, standing some 2 meters in height, with two pairs of wings, one pair larger than the other. Its face is covered in fur and has red bloodshot eyes. Also reported are a pair of small kangaroo-type hands that it held loosely as though it lacked any strength in them. The main witness is a young student at Universidad Regional del Norte, whose name is being kept confidential and who claims that the strange humanoid chased him for 15 minutes on the evening of March the 6th. He was driving a Liberty back to his home after his studies when he saw a bulk on the roadway resembling a hunched-over man who seemed to be covered in a blanket. The figure suddenly stood up, taking two leaps forward, displaying a set of wings similar to those of a bat. The young man floored the accelerator in an attempt to flee, but the strange creature flew with great power, keeping abreast of the vehicle and looking in through the passenger window. He said, quote, "Those were 15 minutes of maximum despair," end quote. Yeah, I think he's got that nailed. All right, back with more open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Back with more open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett filling in for George Norrie. Get on up to my website. It's linked through to the coasttocoastam.com site. Would love to hear from you. Tell me how I did. All right, back to the phones, and we go east of the Rockies. Bob is in Oklahoma City. Good morning, Bob.
Hi, I want to thank you for taking my call. About December of 2007, I was living on a 70-acre family farm, and I woke up one morning and found this really weird imprint on my TV. Anyway, I called the zoo and went down and talked to them, and they told me that it was reptilian. I didn't know what a reptilian was. But the next day, I didn't think anything of it. There was two black SUVs that were sitting outside of the house, and they were in suits. And it didn't take long before I had the NSA follow me around. I had people asking me questions. I'd go into stores, and they'd just kind of make small talk with me. And
wait a second here. Bob, are you telling me that you had a reptilian alien visitor during the night that left a hand or a claw print on your television screen?
Better than that, it left a tail print, and it attacked my dog. It took three blood transfusions to save my dog's life.
Any DNA evidence left on the dog?
I didn't take any. Through different channels, I ended up with talking to Dave, and they're the Utah UFO hunters.
Yes.
And the pictures are posted on their website if anybody wants to look at them. They're in graphic detail.
Pictures of what, the dog?
No, well, they didn't keep the pictures of the dog, but they kept the pictures of the imprint. It's really a good imprint. You know, like if your arm's oily in the summer and you lay it on a glass window,
right?
The imprint is just really fine detail. Well,
and
you like that.
How, Bob, do you know that these gentlemen that were following you around in black SUVs were with NSA?
Well,
not that I'm doubting your story. I'm just curious.
Well, I didn't notice at first that they would be sitting outside of the farm. I lived really in the middle of nowhere. They'd be sitting outside of the farm. They got a tag on the front. They got military stuff on the back. They would sit at the gas station back then, you know, and I'm from a small area, you know, way out in the country. And it just kept going on. I had three computers that crashed. You know, my phones were tapped. I'd have people break in on the line, and I could hear people talking and snickering, and then they'd hang the phone up. And every time I'd try to call Coast to Coast, they'd pick it up and then hang it up. So someone
was you lost their trail because you got through tonight. Were there any threats issued?
No, actually, I sold the place. I had too many weird
weird things happen. Whatever this thing is, it's got three claw marks because it left claw marks on the wood around the house and the ground. There's a lot of sandy area. But I took pictures of all that, of the TVs. You know, I was glad to get out of there. There's too many weird things. The last night I was there, some bright light shining, and I'd taken all the drapes and everything down. This light was super bright, you know, like a landing light on an aircraft, but it was totally quiet. You know, I couldn't see anything other than that bright light. But by the time I got outside, it had backed away so fast. But I grew up in aviation, and it wasn't an airplane or helicopter.
Bob, I don't know what to tell you, man. You had a very unusual visitor. I have a nephew that has, he likes lizards. He's got one of those bearded dragons. This was no bearded dragon. This was no iguana. I don't know what was in your living room that night, but I'm guessing you hope you don't run into it again. Thanks for the call, Bob, in Oklahoma City. Let's go to the wild card line. Dick is in Dallas. Hello, Dick. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi. How are you, Richard?
Well, thank you.
Good. I'm calling sort of see if any of the listeners can contribute, because I've been seeing chemtrails over Dallas for the past year. Every day that it's not very cloudy or a front or high winds aren't going through, those guys are up there drilling away, laying these checkerboard patterns and starburst patterns or whatever, and it spreads out and it forms cloud cover. And I don't know. I can't get anybody to look up, or if they do look up, they say, oh, those are contrails. And, you know, I used to be a pilot. I know a contrail follows maybe 2-3 degrees behind a plane and then disappears. But a chemtrail goes across the sky and it stays there and it spreads out. Is there anybody out there from Dallas that, you know, is noticing this, and are they doing anything about it, or are they sharing my frustration, I guess?
That's a great question. I'm up here in Toronto, Canada, and we are, I would say, a hot spot or a hotbed for chemtrail activity. But again, try getting any answers. You call Transport Canada, and they'll tell you there were no planes flying in the area. At least this is what I'm told by eyewitnesses, and they've been frustrated, like you, Dick, trying to get to the bottom of this. And, of course, very little coverage in terms of the mainstream media about chemtrails. I've heard a lot of interesting theories as to what they might be up to. One is sort of a last-ditch effort to stave off global warming by putting aluminum particulates into the atmosphere to reflect the sun's rays back up and out into the atmosphere. Everything to some sinister depopulation program. I don't know, but it certainly demands a further study, and I really think that the mainstream media has to jump on board and start investigating this in a serious way, not just tongue-in-cheek. And if, you know, if they end up finding out that they're contrails or something else, fine, but you have to ask the questions before you can say you've done your job.
Won't they treat it as a no-no, though? In other words, you know, if you're a reporter or whatever in the mainstream media, don't you know where you can't go?
Well, before you find out where the, the wall is, you've got to start asking questions, and you got to start poking around in the dark. And then once you bump up against that wall, then you know. But you don't until you try, I guess, is my point. And there's just too much evidence, as far as I'm concerned, that in Espanola, here in Ontario, a number of years ago, there was some intensive chemtrail activity, and the next day there were dozens of school children that had to leave school ill. They scraped off some very strange white residue off the ground, took it to a lab. I don't know what the result of that was. Will Thomas, who is, I believe, a Canadian out in Vancouver, is really on the forefront of chemtrail research. You might want to Google him and see if you can get his website and perhaps correspond with him by email. Okay, Dick, thank you for that. All right, up next is the wild card line. Once again, getting lots of wild card calls tonight. Rob is driving in North Carolina. Rob, welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, Richard. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks.
Well, I wanted to talk. George had a guest on a few weeks ago, Seth Disclosure in this reverse engineering. And my frank opinion is I hope we're not doing reverse engineering because $1 trillion a year for 60 years, that's $60 trillion is easy to figure out. Since 1960, the early 60s, that's 45, 50 years, been shooting up chemical rockets with men on them, orbiting, coming down with a sort of a free fall, kind of free fall reentry, and a parachute recovery. And we have gone in the last 45 years from that to an unpowered glider recovery. That's how far we've gone in 45 years. You think about computers in that time and how far we've gone in computers in just that amount of time. And it's unbelievable to me that if they had technology that was reverse engineered, alien technology, they could just use a little bit of it just to make our space program safer, you know, and more cost effective. And certainly people would, they would believe it because if you look at science fiction, we should already be on Mars, populating Mars. So people would buy the fact that we have raised our technology to the point of being able to get to Mars or even further out in space with manned flight. And I just feel like $6 trillion, and we don't have anything to show for it in terms of NASA. It's just ridiculous. I mean,
yeah, that money's going somewhere. And Ben Rich, who used to run Skunk Works for Lockheed Martin, was once quoted, I believe, on his deathbed by a reporter saying, "We have things lying out there in the desert that are 50 years beyond your wildest imagination. And if you've seen it on Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort." So I think that speaks volumes. Rob, thanks for your call. Drive safely in North Carolina. Back to, let's see, the international line. And Dave is in Hamilton, Ontario, just down the QEW. Dave, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Hey, I'm glad to talk to you. You're doing a good job filling in there.
Welcome aboard.
Oh, thanks. I've got some information that I've been trying to get public with, and the local producer here at the TV station in Hamilton, in 07 when I talked to him about it, he said, like, because it was the stuff that was going on about it, that was trying to bust the information about political, judicial, police corruption, and they went after me big time in custody for 8 years on a trumped-up charge. He said to me, how did you survive it? So that kind of indicates that somebody's tried to investigate and or report it and maybe, you know, caught some problems themselves.
So what your question to me then would be what, Dave?
Yeah, I'm trying to find anybody could take this on because anybody that over the 13 years that I've tried to, you know, talk to about this can't get close to it with a 10-foot microphone boom because they catch the heat and sometimes...
Okay, without naming any names, now would this revolve at all around a custody dispute?
No.
No, it wasn't you mentioned trumped-up charges.
Well, I'm from Niagara Falls originally, and that's where it started out, so okay. It was being evicted from a subsidized housing, government housing.
And you feel you've been railroaded by the police and the judiciary and so forth?
Yeah, and I had so much evidence that I got back then that they put me in jail 3 years later. And the attempts on my life is maybe as hard as this is to believe, but I mean there's been attempted muggings, fires, car accidents, even electric shock, and, you know, a second this way or an inch that way kind of thing. And I, you know, might have been not here at this time, but I've been managed to survive it.
Dave, I don't know the particulars of your situation. It sounds like a very difficult one. Just an idea. It sounds like it's possible you might be the victim of some sort of organized harassment, and there are support groups
sounds
for
like
that.
Julian Fantino.
No names, but the person I might consider contacting is... boy, oh boy, now I've lost her name. Oh, Eleanor White, W-H-Y-T-E. And if you Google that name, she runs a... she's been a victim of harassment and electronic harassment for many, many years. I don't know if that's what's going on with you, but that might be a good place to start and I wish you the best of luck with that. All right, back out to the wild card line once again, and Sherry is in San Francisco. Hello, Sherry. Welcome to Coast AM. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much. It's quite late in the show, I realize, but a while earlier, a man said that he had been a fire spotter in Northern California, and I think he said Eureka, somewhere near Eureka.
Correct.
And that he had seen a UFO going north to south over the ocean, I believe he said. Anyway, my heart just leapt. I actually called in about a year ago because there was a show about Betty Hill had told someone they really should check out the connection between UFOs and Bigfoot. And then that was it. They never mentioned what happened. But my heart just leapt then because there's a cliff that I used to park on. And I almost feel like so too embarrassed to say this stuff, but I'd never seen anything weird in my life. And I saw a UFO coming toward the cliff from the ocean. And I wasn't scared, but I said, God, if there's anything evil on this, would you keep me from it? And it did a U-turn and went back out to the ocean. Well, in that same spot later, it took me 2 years to force myself to realize that I did hear a Bigfoot screaming with that horrible sound, and I tried to pretend it was a bear or whatever for almost 2 years till I heard some recordings of it. My whole point here is I think that whole area there of Northern California right on the coast is really strange, but maybe in both good and bad ways. I'm not even sure how to say it.
Sherry, let me ask you, because I've heard this before, and I don't quite understand it. Maybe you can help me out with this. What exactly would the connection between UFOs and Bigfoot be?
Well, I don't know. They never made that point, but apparently Betty Hill dropped a big clue or hint that someone should look into it.
Betty Hill, of course, one of the most celebrated abduction cases of all time. One of the, probably the first prominent one. I was not aware that she mentioned that we should look into the Bigfoot UFO connection.
Well, the guest on Coast to Coast that night, that was the featured topic of the night. And they never did get around to saying, I mean, I kept waiting and waiting, what's the connection? And I'm not sure it was ever really spelled out. And maybe somebody can do some research and find out who was that guest. Get him back on, because he never really explained, is that all she said? I mean, maybe she just dropped the hint. I don't know.
Sherry, maybe you can do a little digging, and it's a good opportunity to get up onto the coasttocoastam.com website. And, of course, they have past show archives there and a search engine. Just put in, you know, Bigfoot and UFOs and see what you come up with, and maybe you'll be able to find out who the guest was in a book, and you'll be well on your way to solving the mystery for yourself. Sherry, thanks for the call. Wow, Bigfoots and UFO. What's the plural of Bigfoot? Shouldn't it be Big Feet? Never quite sure about that either. So many questions, so little time. Out to the wild card line one more time, and Sam is in Long Beach, California. Good morning, Sam. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thanks, Richard. Hey, man, are you interested at all in that astral travel stuff?
Oh, very much so.
Okay, the
very
energy body and all that?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I've actually had quite a few experiences, and if you have any questions on the top of your head, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, I guess my main question is, how do you learn to do that? There are spontaneous occurrences of OBEs, but then there are those people who actually train themselves to do it at will. But I tell you, we can maybe save this for another time if I'm fortunate enough to sit in this chair once again. Would love to hear more about OBEs. Sam in Long Beach, thank you for that. Wow, what a ride it's been. And I need to thank a lot of people. I want to thank Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Tim Banal, Sean Lattiser, Ross Mitchell. What a set of pipes. A brass gong. George Knapp, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, George Norrie, of course. And here at AM 640 Toronto, I want to thank Gord Harris, program director, and Scott Guest. And let's see, Mr. Ambrose, who's sitting in the other booth and has been very helpful tonight. Thank you. Remember, there is nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What I speak in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in a whisper, proclaim.